Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Yo, once upon a time up in Jersey.
For 150 years, New Jersey manufactured chemicals and products that became familiar fixtures in homes: charcoal, lighter fluid, plastic, silk. It's the job of the state's Department of Environmental Protection to ensure that New Jersey's industrial past isn't affecting the health of residents today. But a WNYC investigation finds most of the state's poorest residents are living near contamination with no plan in place to clean it up. As part of our series, Dirty Little Secrets, New Jersey Public Radio's Sarah Gonzalez reports it's not entirely clear whether anybody even knows with certainty what the risks are.
My first memories of growing up in this neighborhood were of seeing these huge drums, these chemical drums.
This is Ana Baptista. She's now an environmental policy professor at the New School.
And they had all this green slime would like wash out into the streets. And we thought it was the coolest thing ever.
Agent Orange, you know, the chemical used to clear the jungle during the Vietnam War, it was made in New Jersey. It's now buried under Newark and cemented over. A public swimming pool here is on stilts, so toxic fumes from an old plastics factory won't seep into it. That's what happened at another public pool in the early 80s. Resident Kathleen Gray Rodriguez used to swim in it.
Down here, Hayes Pool, we were swimming in dioxin. We were swimming in dioxin. The men came with spacesuits on to clean it up.
90% of New Jerseyans live within 1 mile of a contaminated site. This is according to an analysis by WNYC's Data News team. Most of those sites are in some stage of the process to clean up the contamination. That can take years. But an investigation by WNYC has found 1,400 of the state's 14,000 known contaminated sites don't have a cleanup plan. Many have sat orphaned and polluted for years. And those sites are disproportionately found in low-income communities. Months ago, the State Department of Environmental Protection, the DEP, told WNYC those sites were mostly abandoned properties, old gas stations, and former dry cleaners where the state couldn't find the owners. But WNYC went through the list and knocked on doors. And we found open, functioning businesses, a state prison, hospitals, police stations and fire stations, churches, schools, all without any plan to clean up the contamination. The DEP says they've tried to get those sites to comply. They've reached out by phone and by email 69,000 times, they said. I spoke with Philip Scott and Richard Lopez, who work for the city of Newark. Their job is to keep track of contaminated public buildings.
So that would be buildings such as City Hall, courthouse, police stations, fire stations, things like that.
Okay, great. So that's exactly what I wanted to talk about. I tell them about two police stations in Newark that are on the list, but they had no idea there were any public buildings in the city that still needed to be cleaned up.
No.
Really?
No.
not that I could think of.
To know that we're aware of.
So what is the process? Like, who is supposed to make you aware of this?
That's a good question. I would assume that DEP would be required to make us aware of this.
The DEP, the state agency, is no longer responsible for overseeing most of the state's contaminated sites. The state legislature outsourced the work to private contractors in 2009 after kids in South Jersey were exposed to dangerously high levels of mercury at their daycare center. The DEP didn't know it had opened in an old thermometer factory. Private contractors now investigate contaminated sites and determine how they get cleaned up, not the DEP. The DEP is no longer involved unless a site becomes an immediate health risk. Ana Baptista, who grew up here in the Ironbound, says that at best, that makes for patchwork oversight of public health and safety.
Instead of putting more funding and resources into the state to handle these cases and oversee them, they completely shifted it to a privatized system. Here we are years later. Doesn't seem much more efficient or any better. And it's also left behind the issue of accountability, cases that fall in the cracks.
Malcolm X Shabazz High School and Maple Avenue Elementary in Newark slipped through the cracks. Both public schools are run by the state. They made the DEP's list because of soil contamination from old oil tanks. They were given specific deadlines to hire a cleanup contractor. One was in 2012, the other was in 2014. WNYC checked and found neither school had begun to deal with their contamination until a couple weeks ago, days after we asked about it. Mark Peterson with the DEP is not concerned. He said these sites that are still waiting for a cleanup plan are low risks.
I want to assure you that as best as we can, we're identifying what are the sites, what's known to be there, and is there potential impact.
If there is a potential for health risks, Peterson says the DEP steps in.
If I don't have a party willing to do the work and there's a potential human exposure, we have public funds to do that, and I do not hesitate.
But they don't always step in time. Some of the low-risk sites have become immediate threats. That's what happened to Modesto Vieira. Meet Modesto. He's a singer.
I do Frank Sinatra, New York, of course.
He moved to Newark's Ironbound neighborhood from Portugal in the 1970s and is a proud U.S. citizen.
I never went to the army, but I was registered.
We're outside of Modesto's dream home.
Can you hear that?
And this sucking noise he's trying to get me to hear?
It's like psss.
That's an exhaust pipe that starts under his garage and runs along the side of his house. It's sucking up toxic fumes from the soil and shooting the fumes into the air. No one told Modesto his house was built on the site of a former lighter fluid factory. In fact, homes were never supposed to be built there.
It was like a gassy smell, and we couldn't figure out what it was.
In 2013, the state became aware of it and found residents on Modesto's entire block had been breathing in toxic, cancer-causing fumes for 12 years.
Ever since they dug the holes in here, the air has gotten better, and I don't feel the headache as much.
The DEP installed the air filters, but it's a temporary fix. The contamination is still there, and it's spreading. It moved a block over, and now the state is testing the block next to that, where Kathleen Gray Rodriguez lives.
When I got that notice, it scared me.
She got a letter from the DEP in October that there may be toxic fumes in her home.
In my home that I'm in every day, breathing.
According to an analysis by WNYC, 3 out of 4 residents who live below the poverty line in New Jersey are living within a mile of a site that has yet to start the cleanup process. It's 75% of the state's black population and 80% of the state's Hispanic population, compared to 40% of white residents.
We pay taxes. Okay, some more than others, but the government, they have to do the right thing. I don't care how costly it is.
Cleaning up contaminated sites is expensive. And everyone I spoke with, developers, owners of contaminated sites, the DEP, they all say sites don't usually get cleaned up until someone wants to buy the property. Mark Mariello used to run the DEP before Governor Chris Christie's administration. And he agrees with the advocates who say the new privatized cleanup process leaves behind low-income communities where the land isn't considered valuable.
You look at Camden, you look at Newark, you look at Trenton and Patterson. There's a significant relationship between communities of color and communities of poverty and the level of contamination. This is a really big deal.
The DEP stands by their system. They say private contractors are making progress on a long list of contaminated sites. And they say they will step back in if there's an immediate health risk. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
In Brazil, a new campaign called Virtual Racism, Real Consequences, targets people who make racist comments online by putting up a giant billboard with their tweet near where they live. But as South America correspondent Lourdes Garcia Navarro explains, it's not the only project tackling racism and the legacy of slavery in Brazil.
The billboards are simple, all white, with the comment written in black bold. One of them, put up in the Brazilian state of Espírito Santo, reads, "I came home stinking like a black person." The name and picture of the person who wrote that on Twitter is blurred out, but the organizers track down where they live and the placard is in their neighborhood. Those targeted have taken their tweets down.
They call women, mainly women, macaca.
Monkey.
They're talking about their hair. They are talking about the color of their skin. They are calling them prostitutes.
That's campaign organizer Jurema Wernecki from activist group Criola. She says their message is simple. There is no real anonymity, and racism in Brazil is illegal. Despite having more black people living here than any country outside Africa, Wernecki says racism in Brazil is actually on the rise. And that's because in the last decade, new laws like affirmative action are changing things.
We are entering the universities. We are entering many different spaces. They are so angry because we are putting pressure in their privilege.
Brazil was the last country in the Americas to end slavery. It imported more enslaved people from Africa than any other country, well over 4 million. After slavery ended, there wasn't legal segregation like in the U.S. There was something more insidious, a social apartheid that still exists today. Other groups say that in order for the country to move forward, it first needs to look back.
Esse relatório é relatório parcial.
Marcelo Dias is the president of the Truth Commission on Black Slavery in Rio de Janeiro. He helped co-author a 311-page report released this past week on slavery in Brazil. It calls for the first time on the Brazilian government to apologize for the practice. We've had this struggle in Brazil, he says, because the ruling class always said there was no racism here. They always denied it. How can you fight against something if it doesn't exist, he asks.
O relatório cumpre a tarefa.
A report, he says, seeks to rescue the real story of slavery and of black people in Brazil. That story was, up until recently, never even taught in schools. But another literary event in recent weeks seeks to make learning about black history more accessible.
This account needs to jump the wall to a wider audience.
Bruno Veras is a doctoral student in Canada and the brains behind Project Bakwakwa. It's the memoir of an educated African civil servant who was kidnapped and then sold into slavery in Brazil. The website went live last week, and it's aimed at showing that enslaved Africans were not things.
Before being slaves, they were people with ideas, with culture. So Bakwakwa account, when he talks about himself, about his experience, about his contradictions, about his personality, people can think about this African heritage and the history of African people in Brazil.
He says Brazil has to come to terms with how the brutal past is influencing the very difficult present. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
I did mention the inaugural Khayelitsha Book Fair, which took place last month.
But this is not just about the book fair, and I think it is related to the conversation we were having in the open line. What conversation were we having? Well, we're talking about the reconciliation barometer, which indicated that a third of people surveyed, and I need to say that, two-thirds of people surveyed generally have little or no trust in other racial groups. And I used some of the findings to ask you to personally account for what you do, what you observe, what you think about our race relations in South Africa. And race relations permeate, or they're in every part of our lives. You know, they're reflected in every part of their lives, of our lives, and no less in the literary or literature space. Earlier this year, you may have been reading it in the newspapers as well, there were calls to decolonize some literary festival, to decolonize the literary space. And author, and he's also a Mandela Rhodes Scholar, Thando Mqolozane, sparked a great deal of debate about the South African literary system. And I did have a question of, so what are we going to do about it? But what are we going to do about it is not the entire answer. I think it is important to diagnose the problem, to talk about the problem if it is there, and then get to solutions about transforming the literary space. So let's welcome Thando Mqolozane, who I have just I've mentioned that he's an author and he's a Mandela Rhodes Scholar. Good morning to you, Thando. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Reddy, and good morning to your listeners.
Thank you so very much. Before we even get to the Khayelitsha Book Fair, I would like you, now that we're talking and we're not reading in the newspaper, as somebody who writes, as somebody who interacts with words every single day, words and ideas, what do you think is problematic about the way these ideas are reflected through the literary space?
Okay, so I'll try to give you an answer to your very difficult question. Mm-hmm. And my attempt at answering that is that so the literary space is entirely based in the cities, in the suburbs, and systematically excludes the black communities from participating in it. So if you are black and you live in a township, you do not have access to those ideas. You do not have access to the books that are being written about you and probably for you, and there is absolutely no aesthetically relevant, culturally relevant literary activity in any black community that I know of. Well, that is until now that we started the Khayelitsha Book Fair, which I'm hoping will be replicated in other black communities. So the big thing is that because the literary landscape that we have was formed not with black people in mind and is not now being maintained with black people in mind, black people are excluded from it, and I see no reason for us to beg to be integrated into this system. We need a new thing, and that new thing will not be to modify what we have, but to start a whole new thing that is not framed by concepts of colonialism.
Okay. Is the exclusion, Thando, historic? Is it geographic? Or is it your observation that despite the historical divisions, if that's what you believe, there are enough resources at our disposal to make the literary space more accessible to those who are excluded? And how?
So my opinion is that, I'm repeating myself now, that you had colonialism, and colonialism, which, by the way, I include apartheid in colonialism because it's just a derivative of that. And the purpose of these systems was to exclude a particular group of people from the system and only use them as labor, etc. And that included things like literature. Mm-hmm. And now that we have democracy, that has not changed. So people are still excluded in the same way that they were previously from the system. And what we need to do is to think of what we should have done when we had an opportunity to turn things around and didn't. So I'm not just going to advocate for, you know, a transformation. That's what we've been doing, by the way, some mm-hmm. of us in the, you know, in the, for the last 20 years or so, trying to change, you know, these festivals, trying to change publishers, this and that. But the reason why I came to this decision is, mm-hmm. Is realizing that that change is not taking place, and where some change is taking place, it is not enough, and probably we shouldn't have been asking to be integrated on something that is not conceptually about us.
Mm-hmm.
We need to think of new ways, you know, and we need to think of a new system that will accommodate us in the way that we should be.
Okay, so many things that you've raised there, Thando. Let me start with one of them, because you know, somebody can argue that if black writers are appearing in panels, if black writers are being published, if black people are now telling their stories, that is a plus for decolonizing the literary space. And we'll talk in detail about that. But let's talk about the book festivals themselves, because they are but one aspect of a very complex continuum. When it comes to the literature festivals themselves, is your antipathy, is your aversion towards the people who are in the audience, the content of the discussions, or the people who make up the panel?
All of those things.
Okay.
Entirely. All of those things. First of all, you know, it's the geography. If I grew up in Guguletu and in the villages in Whittle, and if I hadn't moved from there and now live in the suburbs, I would have absolutely no access to those things. Right? That's the first thing. I wouldn't be able to go to Franschhoek. I would see no reason why I have to come to the CBD to go to the Open Book Festival, or why I have to go to Durban to a university that is based in the suburbs there, right? And then the second thing is that so black people don't go to these things, and then you find that the majority of the audience there is old white women who have nothing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you find that when they engage with you as an author, with my 7 or so years of experience as a black author in the colonial literary system, I find that here I'm not being treated as literary talent. Here there is an undercurrent, you know, a suspicious undercurrent where I'm being viewed, or what is happening is rather that the questions that are being asked, the comments that are coming, suggest that these people somehow want to confirm a long-held suspicion that somehow, as a black person, I am inferior to them, and they have a certain level of superiority to me, right? Mm-hmm. That's the main thing. That's what's happening. And all black writers who have been to these literary spaces in particular will have experienced one version of that or another. The kind of black author that is treated differently is the one who has assimilated into whiteness better. Some of us who reject that kind of thing completely, we're seen as complete outcasts, you know. We're not welcome in that space. And I don't see why for the last 7 years we have been begging to be integrated into this thing. You know, it's like asking to be put nicely into a fire. You know, there's no better way of doing that. So we have to leave, we have to go, and those who are staying, let them stay. They will realize it as time unfolds.
Stay with us, Thando. I've got a few more questions for you. And as I said earlier, it's not possible to get to the Khayelitsha Book Fair, or indeed a conversation about alternative platforms, without talking about the current platforms. Just stay with us. And our lines are open on 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. He's the author of, amongst others, A Man Who's Not a Man, Hear Me Alone, and Importance. Those are some of the titles of his work. Our lines are open for you. We are talking to Thando Mgolozane about the literary space in South Africa. It's 21 minutes past 10 o'clock. Join our conversation. I'm chatting to Thando Mgolozane. Thando, let's go back then to the theme that we started. We agree that you'd battle to find a bookstore in the township, right?
Yeah.
I have heard of an elderly man. He's still alive, by the way. And his father started the first black publishing company. I'll just find his name. And he's still alive. He's in his late 70s. His name is
Matthews.
No, not James Matthews. I'll remember it just now. Yeah. I'll remember it just now. He himself has written some poetry. I met him last year, but I'll talk about that in a moment. And that's where the bookstores are not in the township. I grew up in the township, and I believe that you grew up in a township and a village from the last thing I read. So, Thando, my question therefore is, should we not start the debate there, where bookstores, libraries, access to books, where books are produced, should we not start the debate there, where the factory, as it were, is located? Because it seems to me that the debate around Franschhoek is not about Franschhoek. It's about where a literature festival is located. And if it's located in an area where you find the factory, the bookstores and the publishing company, then it will remain that way. Shouldn't the project be to set up the factory in those areas where there are no factories?
Yeah. So the whole thing, my whole point really is that we need to change the system, the entire system, all the way from who owns the forest that produces the paper on which the words are printed, who is the editor and who is the publisher, and all of those things. The entire system has to change. Just establishing a literary festival in Khayelitsha does not change the system. That's one tiny element of it. Because in any case, for the last 20 years, there's been a lot of initiatives by literary practitioners who thought up of ideas. For example, there's Phakama Mbonambi, who started Words Etc., a literary magazine, a brilliant literary magazine. But it had to fold because, you know, the system was not receptive to it. We've had instances where people started bookstores that were specializing in African and diasporan literature, and some of those have had to fold, and some of those that are remaining now are struggling really seriously because the system is not receptive to them. So the entire system has to change. And the way in which the entire system has to change is not to, you know, modify it or take some elements of it and apply them in the villages and the townships. No. Decolonization. And decolonization means you have to undo the whole thing, undo the whole framework of the system, and allow yourself an opportunity to imagine something new that is not framed by colonialism. So, for example, the way in which we are going to do culture book fair in Khayelitsha, we are not going to use the conventional library system. We have identified households that we will give books. Say, at Reddy's house, there are 100 books, and here is a catalogue of these books. Mm-hmm. And people can come and read at your backyard or at your lawn, if you allow it. And people can come and borrow and give books at your house, and you will have a series of these houses in the communities. Because our people do not identify with the libraries, our ordinary people don't identify with these libraries that exist or have existed in our communities in the last 20 years. Because these libraries do not contain relevant literature that our people can actually engage with. This is why when there is a protest, you will find that in a protest about water or sanitation or something like that, our people will walk and march past an educare center, a creche that is built using zinc that they built on their own. And they will walk past a church that they built on their own. But they will burn up a library because that library is an anomaly. It's the thing the government gave to us, which is a white elephant. So we have to build a system that is aesthetically relevant, And when we build that system, it's not just to copy what is in the current literary landscape. So yes, we need black publishers, we need black editors, we need all of those things. I think the government will certainly have to play a role, because this, in any case, is the responsibility of the government. The system cannot change without that happening. As I've alluded before, private individuals who are black have tried things, but because the system is not receptive to them, those have failed.
Oh, how I love the system. System, system, stay in the system. System, system, stay in the system.
World nigga law.
Affirmative action in higher education was once again under attack before the Supreme Court today. In the past, the court has allowed race to be one of the many factors in college admissions. But as the court has grown more conservative, it's moved to reconsider the issue, including a case from Texas that was before the court today for the second time. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1996, the lower courts ruled that the University of Texas could not consider race at all in admissions, and the number of minorities promptly plummeted by 40%. That, in turn, sent the political and educational establishment scrambling. The result was something called the 10% Plan, enacted by the state legislature. It guaranteed a spot at UT for any student graduating in the top 10% of his or her public high school class. And because Texas schools are largely segregated by housing patterns, that ensured a small but significant minority enrollment. By law, 75% of the slots were filled that way, and 25% are filled by combining class rank with other factors, including board scores, special skills, economic status, and since 2003, race and ethnicity. That was after the Supreme Court gave the green light to limited consideration of race. Enter Abigail Fisher, a white applicant who claimed she was not admitted because of her race. On the steps of the Supreme Court today, she read a statement.
Like most Americans, I don't believe that students should be treated differently based on their race. Hopefully, this case will end racial classifications and preferences in admissions at the University of Texas.
UT has flatly denied that Fisher was the victim of racial discrimination. It said that her grades and board scores were sufficiently low that she would not have been admitted under any circumstances. The Texas case could well decide the fate of affirmative action, not just in Texas, not just for state schools, but for private colleges and universities, too. The court is closely divided. Four conservative justices are adamantly opposed to any consideration of race. A fifth, Justice Kennedy, is deeply skeptical, but has said that colleges and universities have a compelling interest in having a diverse student body. The court's four liberal justices support affirmative action programs, but one of them, perhaps the most knowledgeable member on this subject, former Harvard Law School Dean Elena Kagan, is recused because she participated in the case when she served in the Obama administration. So the stage was set today for a battle royale in which Justice Kennedy's vote is likely to be decisive. Abigail Fisher's lawyer, Bert Rhine, immediately faced tough questions from Justice Sotomayor, who has said she was the beneficiary of affirmative action. Assume there was a need for more diversity at UT. What was wrong with the way the UT plan used race? She asked. Rhine replied that to comply with earlier Supreme Court rulings, each minority applicant would have to be measured against other applicants one by one. My God, said Sotomayor, that sounds like you'd be using race more than this plan does. Justice Ginsburg observed that the 10% plan itself is driven by one thing only, and that one thing is race. It's totally dependent on having racially segregated neighborhood schools, she said. Justice Kennedy pressed Fisher's lawyer on another matter. You argue that UT's goals are insufficiently concrete, he said. What, in your view, would be a sufficiently concrete set of criteria to achieve diversity? Lawyer Rhine said that the school would have to conduct studies to determine whether there's a critical mass of minority students that allows for a vibrant exchange of views. Chief Justice Roberts, but how do you do that? Rhine acknowledged, it's not easy, but he added, it's not our job to do it. Justice Alito, a consistent opponent of affirmative action plans, seemed to suggest one measure. Could the university conduct a study measuring classroom diversity? Justice Kennedy picked up on that point, asking whether, in the absence of any trial on the facts, the court should send the case back a second time to the lower courts to look at more facts. It does seem to me, he said, we're just arguing the same case. It's as if nothing had happened. Justice Scalia, incredulous. It was the university's burden, so now we're going to give them a do-over? Next up was the university's lawyer, Gregory Garr, who told the justices that the 10% plan had failed to provide enough diversity at the university. Justice Alito told Garr that he found that argument troubling because it assumes that the minorities admitted under the 10% plan are not leaders, not dynamic, not change agents. It's really based on terrible stereotyping, he said. It's exactly the opposite, replied Garr. The university wants those students. It applauds those students, but it does not assume that all minorities think alike. It wants people from different experiences, different backgrounds, who are going to have different contributions to the class. Justice Alito again asked whether the university was measuring classroom diversity. Yes, replied lawyer Garr, we've doubled African-American enrollment from 2002 to 2008, and that has increased classroom diversity. Chief Justice Roberts, caustically, what unique perspective does a minority student bring to a physics class? Justice Scalia, there are those who contend that it does not benefit African Americans to get them into the University of Texas, where they do not do well, as opposed to having them go to a less advanced school, a slower track school, where they do well. Lawyer Garr shot back that the academic performance of minorities admitted under UT's affirmative action program was higher than those admitted under the Top 10 plan. Frankly, he added, the solution to the problem of student body diversity is not to set up a system where minorities go to separate schools. They are inferior schools, he said, and now is not the time to roll back student diversity in America. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Why haven't you learned anything?
In Northwest News from KPLU, a suspended Western Washington University student pleaded not guilty to hate crime charges today. Tyson Campbell, who is white, is accused of making racially motivated online threats against the student body president, who's African American. KPLU Law and Justice reporter Paula Whistle reports from Bellingham.
Tyson Campbell, wearing a dress shirt and slacks and with his hair now closely cropped, stood quietly next to his attorney as he entered a not guilty plea. Now, reading the charging papers, it's clear that what happened was the culmination of an increasingly heated online exchange. Much of it seems to have been sparked by a Cairo TV report about efforts to rethink the school's Viking mascot, with some students of color saying it wasn't inclusive enough. Now, at one point on the anonymous social media site Yik Yak, someone makes reference to the student body president's Facebook post where they allege she calls white male students at Western baby KKK, and they say the school should discipline her for the comment. Someone, now alleged to be Tyson Campbell, responds, let's lynch her. Others weighed in immediately, saying the remark went too far, but the damage was done. The threat prompted a cancellation of classes for a day, and Tyson Campbell is now slated to go on trial in February for a hate crime. Paula Whistle, KPLU News.
You could take a million lies, my brother. Need I remind you that you got no respect for human life in South Carolina.
Eight students at the Citadel Military College in Charleston, South Carolina, have been suspended after photos were found of them on Facebook wearing white hoods that some say look like KKK hoods.
No, not
some
at all.
Think that. What weirdos those people must be. I'm joking, of course, because if you turn to the mainstream media, in some forms at least, you'll see something like this video.
And scandal at the Citadel to tell you about. The South Carolina Military College now suspending several students over this controversial photograph. You can see seven cadets wearing all white clothes and hoods over their heads that some say resemble the KKK.
Some say.
That beautiful presenter there is an idiot. Some say?
Some say. No.
Some say?
I don't know where they get that idea. Okay. So now, if the Citadel had no history of racism, you
yes.
might say, like, boy, maybe there's some real knuckleheads there. I mean, I would have hoped that one of them would be like, okay, I get it, man. We're trying to be ghosts.
This
but,
looks
but,
bad.
But let's look in the mirror for 1 second and realize how shitty this looks. Right? Like, so there wasn't anybody in the room. There wasn't an adult. There wasn't one of the cadets who was like, this guys, at a minimum, this looks awkward.
Yeah.
Right? So.
Well, okay, yeah, here's why it's not ghosts, okay? Because they would have used the full sheet.
Yeah.
That's just the pillowcase.
That's a hood.
That's a hood. Yeah. That's not a ghost. That's a hood.
Yeah, it's like you should realize the awkwardness when, like, it's sort of like turning in the eye holes. It's like, dude, I can barely see to light this cross. The eye holes keep moving. Like, this isn't right at all. But anyway, one of the heads of the Citadel doesn't want you to think that this is anything racist, despite their history, which we're going to get to. So the president, Lieutenant General John W. Rosa, was quick to explain the incident as a group of students singing Christmas carols as part of a Ghosts of Christmas Past skit. Well, unfortunately, there are ghosts of their past, but it's not of Christmas, it's of the Citadel. So the Post and Courier, which has been reporting on this, recalls an October 1986 incident in which five white Citadel cadets entered black student Kevin Nesmith's room wearing white sheets and towels and shouting racial insults. They left a charred...
You mean Christmas caroling?
Yes. It was, yeah, they were swinging around the Christmas tree or something. They left a charred paper cross in his room. After that, he eventually ended up leaving despite the slight punishment that they gave to the kids who had terrorized him in that way. The NAACP then filed an $800,000 federal lawsuit on his behalf, claiming that racial bigotry has historically been tolerated and sanctioned by officials at the Citadel. Now, really fast, we have a couple of other incidents from more recent history. Former Citadel cadet Jordan Jackson told the Post and Courier that she was a victim of racial harassment at the military college almost from the moment she walked through its doors the previous fall. She was the target of racial epithets and racist notes. She eventually quit the school rather than endure more insults. And so they also have the Confederate flag up on the campus. The Charleston County Councilman Henry Darby received hundreds of phone and email messages after he asked the Citadel to remove the Confederate Naval Jack flag from Summerall Chapel on campus. That's just after he asked it, not like required it. Several of the messages from people identifying themselves as Citadel alumni included racial slurs and the use of the N-word.
Now look at the guy on the left in the Citadel sweatshirt. Mm-hmm. That look on his face isn't like we're doing a sing-along. It's like we're getting away with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're getting away with being a bunch of racist motherfuckers.
Holy shit.
And we're having a good time doing it.
Going by the arms, all of those people are white.
Yeah, that's an interesting coincidence.
And they
by
must
the way,
be from Canada because none of them are wearing their shoes indoors.
So
you put the hood on.
It's not a...
It's 2015.
22% of the Citadel is now black. So the fact that they didn't have anybody black that's ghosts could also be somewhat telling, right?
He would have complained.
Yeah. There's some chance that that's what would have happened.
Yeah.
At the very least, if they had asked someone black, they might have said, hey, guys, this doesn't look great.
Yeah.
Right? So, look, given the context of the racial issues at the Citadel... Not just in 1986, which was the first story, but in 2013, which is one of the more recent stories that John told you about. At a minimum, given all that racial context at that school, wouldn't you want to be more careful? So if you're not careful at all and you do something that looks terrible like this, it's almost as if Wes said, we're getting away with it. Yeah.
That's a look on his face. We're getting away with it.
Yeah. And look, the first reaction of the president.
They're never going to think what's best for the school or the other people. That's who they are. They're going to think, I care what's best for me and putting everyone else down.
Yep.
And you see, the first reaction from the president is, oh, no, this is nothing. It's just a Christmas carol. So I'm sure he's going to look into it very diligently, and he's going to make sure that they get punished, like his predecessors have. No, it's an old boys club there.
Yeah, it's just coincidentally in South Carolina.
Tennessee. The issue of race has been igniting controversy across the country, from the Black Lives Matter protests to the fight over the Confederate flag in South Carolina. Well, in Memphis, a group called Responding to Racism is hosting a prayer service today to discuss how people in the community can take action. Sharon Pavelda is one of the founding members, along with her husband, Reverend Randall Mullins. She joins us now. And Sharon, one thing that you're doing is going around Memphis and surrounding Shelby County to mark where lynchings have happened.
That's correct. This is this prayer service that we're having is the beginning of our coming alongside of the Equal Justice Initiative. And this is an initiative to find and mark all the places of lynchings in the United States. Unfortunately, in Tennessee, right here in our own county, there are 21 of them that happened between 1882 and 1930. So at this first prayer meeting, we're going to be reading the names of the 21 known victims of lynching. As Ida B. Wells said, the way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them. Hmm. We're hoping for more truth, a deeper honesty, but grounded in this newer sense of humility that we don't have the answers, but we are part of the ongoing legacy of racial terror in our country.
Well, here you are trying to, as you say, shine light on the truth and point out things that are not currently pointed out to the general public. Of course, there are a lot of people in this country right now who want to take away markers to people in the past who they find abhorrent. And in fact, right there in Memphis, you have pointed out that there is a site of the former home of Nathan Bedford Forrest, who made money on a slave trading business, and you don't like the fact that that marker is there for him.
Well, actually, we acknowledge the fact that in that time, which was during the 30s and 40s, when there was this lost cause movement of putting up all kinds of memorials to the Confederacy, this was the way it was then. So rather than perhaps tearing it down, what we're saying is, let's write another one that says, it just states that Forrest was a partner in Forrest and Maples, slave dealers whose offices were nearby, and that by the time he was in the Confederacy, he was one of the richest men in the South, and that on a certain date, he led Confederate cavalry troops that captured nearby Fort Pillow and massacred over 300 African-American Union soldiers. And we feel like the education of what actually happened and how it is still happening with a different face and a different name is how our hearts will be open to do this differently.
So the way to deal with some of these monuments to people who were slave owners or were against desegregation or things like that would be just to add more to the description at the monuments that celebrate them.
Well, that's one way. The truth is, we white people especially don't know what to do next. That's why we have prayer meetings. That's why interfaith, we are gathering together and saying, we need a new humility and we need courage as we look at this painful truth of the violence and terror of slavery that is still with us today. Now we see them in the shootings. You know, in the past, there were these lynchings where people brought picnics. There were 5,000 people watching this. And we were horrified and we say, that could never happen here. We wouldn't do that. And yet we click on the videos of the killings of young black men. We watch them. We watch it happen, and it goes viral. How is that different?
Have you faced any resistance from the community, from people who say you don't understand or there's nothing you can do to fix these issues?
Of course. And, you know, not so long ago, maybe we were ourselves part of some of those groups. So we have real compassion for that fear. There is so much fear here that it blocks out our powers of action and rational relating to each other. Some of the fear is that, you know, don't do this. You're just going to rile up a lot of antagonism, or don't drag up the past. And it reminds me so much, I have to tell you, of a story I learned in Sunday school from the Hebrew Bible about Moses in the desert. And there were all these snakes, these poisonous snakes that had come and people were dying. And they said, please, please help us. Ask your Lord to help us. And so Moses said, well, what shall we do? And the Lord told him to make a serpent and to put it on a pole. And that whenever a serpent bit someone, that person would look at the serpent of bronze and live. Now, that story intrigued me as a child, but I can't help but keep thinking about right now that somehow looking at that thing that poisons us, looking at the reality that we've been living with, trying to push down because, oh, it'll only bring up pain of the past. Well, you know what? We're living in so much pain today. And perhaps what we need to look at through art, this was a bronze serpent after all, but through art, through new ways of being together, maybe if we are willing to look at this, we will be shining that light of truth upon us as Ida B. Wells had hoped we would.
That's Sharon Pavelda joining us from Memphis, where she and her husband and a number of others have formed a grassroots group called Responding to Racism. Sharon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for being interested in Memphis.
Fires kill more children than any other home accident. And many are seriously burnt.
Don't be alarmed.
Don't let this happen to your children. Listen to me, Eazy-E, and set a good example for fire safety. Take special precautions against fire dangers for children.
Teach your children household fire rules and urge other parents to practice fire safety in their homes. Toys could be replaced. Your kids can't.
They're making threatening racist comments on social media. Way 31's Andy Devine is here, and he talked to the fire chief today. Andy.
Deborah, the termination of firefighter Josh Tidwell comes after a comment he made on Facebook to a post about KKK flyers circulating in the Arab area targeting Muslims. In the post, he asked for African Americans to be hanged. Chief Raymond Bodine with the 4C Volunteer Fire Department tells me the board made the decision to terminate Tidwell's membership after seeing the comment on Facebook. The chief says that he called Tidwell a talented firefighter whom he once chose as a safety officer, but he says after seeing the comment, he decided to put the decision up to a vote.
To take care of the respect of our fire department. We've got a good, respectable community here, and I want people to continue to respect our fire department and our people that are in it.
Now, I've been in contact with Tidwell today, and he says that he plans to make some sort of comment soon about the Facebook comment and his membership termination. If he does that, we'll have that for you later tonight at 10.
Well, the law was in the South at that time that a white man cannot rape a black woman, period. That was the unwritten law. That was the common law all over the South. Black women, I mean, that came in, I mean, with their clothes torn and all like that, and said some white man raped them, rather. They run out of there. Yeah, you don't arrest a white man for raping a black woman because they, you know, it was just understood. White men don't rape black women. Black women are loose. That's a false charge.
Wow. And this was just understood by black people.
Understood. It was understood. Wow. Don't you come in this jailhouse talking about some white man raped you. We're going to arrest you for a false charge if you stay in here talking about it. Now get out of here and don't come back unless you want to go to jail yourself for disturbing the peace. You can ask any, you know, person came along at that time, if that's true. Don't arrest no white man on no charge of some black woman saying that he raped her. You know how you nigger women are. Get out of here, you know.
Well, today, prayer for a former law officer now convicted of raping several women. Daniel Holtzclaw broke down when the verdict was read against him last night. He's now looking at 263 years in prison. Today, his accusers told their stories and then prayed for Holtzclaw. News Channel 4's Kristen Shanahan has the details.
She is a survivor. Sade is a survivor. This is a victorious time.
These two women are being called heroes for coming forward with their stories about their encounter with Daniel Holtzclaw.
I came forward. I had the strength and courage to do so because I didn't want to see this happen to no one else.
Janie Liggins was the first to speak up.
I was out there alone and helpless, didn't know what to do. And in my mind, all I could think that he was going to shoot me. He was going to kill me.
This mother and grandmother says Holtzclaw pulled her over for no reason, then sexually assaulted her.
He did so many things to me, and I was so afraid. God's will, he let me live. And he let me live to tell this story.
Sade Hill says Holtzclaw sexually assaulted her in a hospital.
I mean, I was scared. I didn't know what to do. I feel like I was in survival mode, so I had to do what he was making me do.
A terrifying experience, these women say they've lost sleep over.
I went to therapy. I had a stroke behind this. And
I still live with this day after day.
A little comfort came when the jury found the former police officer guilty of half the sex crimes he was accused of.
We are pleased with the 18 counts that we received. We are not pleased with the 18 that we didn't. There were 5 women who did not receive justice. That is a problem.
263, serve your time!
Now they're working to move forward, demanding change.
There has to be a conversation about sexual assault, about rape, and about the specific care that black women need and women of color need when these situations happen.
I feel like we all know what's done in the dark will come out to the light.
The case isn't over yet. Holtzclaw is set for formal sentencing in late January. And we're told 5 of the accusers are planning a civil suit against the city.
I want to be a cop.
A pregnant woman tased by Chicago police. And tonight, allegations the Independent Police Review Authority has dragged its feet on the case.
As Larry Ellen reports, it's the latest in a string of complaints against IPRA for its failure to hold officers accountable for misconduct.
My client, Elena Turner, was pregnant at the time she was tased. She had a miscarriage 2 days after being tased.
In her lawsuit against the Chicago Police Department, Elena Turner claims 2 years ago, Officer Patrick Kelly tased her during an argument over the towing of her fiancé's van. The 30-year-old Turner was charged with obstruction of justice. She was cleared of all charges, but the city, she says, should be liable for causing her miscarriage.
She went to the hospital the next day, and then there was bleeding, and I believe it was about 2 or 3 days later.
Turner's attorney says within days of the incident, Turner filed a complaint against Kelly and other officers with the Independent Police Review Authority. Now, 2 years later, he's obtained IPRA's records showing how the case was or wasn't investigated.
We've sort of created our own name for IPRA during this case, and that's the Irrelevant Police Review Authority. They're not doing their job.
The case logs show that for almost 2 years after the complaint, IPRA failed to interview Kelly or take other steps to investigate the case. This despite a track record of complaints against Kelly.
Officer Kelly, in a 10-year period, amassed over 25 complaints, most of them in alleging violence. He was arrested twice by the Chicago Police Department.
The only complaint IPRA upheld against Kelly, Granick says, was the case where Kelly resisted his arrest by a female police sergeant.
IPRA was created because OPS did nothing. We now realize that IPRA is the same game.
Earlier this week, the mayor appointed a new director for IPRA. An IPRA spokesman told me tonight that the investigation regarding Officer Kelly is still pending, so they won't comment. City attorneys also declined to discuss the pending lawsuit. Back to you.
Larry, thank you. IPRA's new director, Sharon Fairley, has promised that her only agenda is the pursuit of integrity and transparency.
None of your business. Recently, a state appeals court in Pennsylvania ruled that its state officials and judges didn't have to release internal emails to the media saying they weren't pertaining to government business. The emails in question came to light when Pennsylvania's embattled Attorney General, Catherine Kane, announced their existence, describing them as racist, sexist, and indeed pornographic. Pennsylvania's Commonwealth Court, in a majority decision, turned aside a media suit brought to release them in their entirety. In other words, it's none of your business. Imagine if you are a person of color, I hate that term, or a woman suing a state official in one of its courts. Wouldn't you want to know if your judge and attorney general shared racist, sexist, or pornographic materials with each other? What if you're a white guy charged with a pornographic offense? Wouldn't you want to know if your judge shared smut with the state prosecutor, or if the prosecutor regularly shared such stuff with a justice of the Supreme Court? Well, it's none of your business. Case closed. It's none of your business, because boys will be boys, and you're not part of the good old boys club. It's a right to know act in Pennsylvania, yes, but this, you ain't got the right to know. If you don't like it, tough. The court has ruled. It's none of your business. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Now, let me just say, I want to go on the record as saying that I am so deeply proud of the Attorney General Eric Holder, that he stood his ground and did not back away from that truth. And all of us as black people should stand by him. If you go on the web or make a comment, everybody should, black should be commending him for taking that stand. That's helping all of us. Do you see that? The Attorney General of the United States. Now, people can get angry with him if they want to maintain racism. But those people who want to end racism, white supremacy, should be very proud that that black man is up there and taking that stand. I feel so very good to learn that.
Now to a newsmaker interview with someone who's been one of the most prominent and polarizing members of the Obama administration.
Damn you, Obama.
Former Attorney General Eric Holder. He was the first African-American to serve as this country's top law enforcement official. He's also one of this country's longest-serving attorneys general. When he came into office, he promised to restore the department's reputation for aggressive enforcement of civil rights laws and to change the country's approach to criminal justice. He also became a lightning rod for conservatives. In 2012, he became the first sitting cabinet member to be held in contempt by Congress for failing to deliver documents related to the Fast and Furious gun-running operation in Arizona. After stepping down earlier this year, he returned to private practice as a partner at the law firm Covington & Burling. I visited him at his office in Washington, D.C., where we talked about his life and work since leaving office. Looking back on your tenure as Attorney General, was it what you thought it would be?
That's an interesting question. Parts of it were, I mean, I grew up in the Justice Department, and so some of it was extremely familiar. But the opposition and the vehemence of the opposition to some of the policy positions that we took in the administration, I think, took me by surprise.
What role do you think race played in that?
Hard to say. I mean, it's hard to look into people's hearts, their minds. I think for some, that was a component of the opposition. But I think the larger part of it really was ideological. And I think the hyper-partisan atmosphere in which we now operate in Washington, D.C., I think is really kind of the thing that was the driver. So I think it was really that, more ideology than race.
If it is purely ideological, then what's the relevance of your being the first African-American attorney general and the president being the first black president?
Well, I think it certainly is an indication of the progress that this nation has made. You know, for some people, yeah, race was a factor, but it's hard to quantify that. It is much easier for me to see the ideological positions that were taken and that I think were the drivers for so much of what they did and so much of what they say.
It's interesting because the conservatives blame the president and you for being the divisive ones. In fact, they use that term very often in connection with both you and the president, divisive and polarizing. And I just wonder, what do you think accounts for this very large difference of opinion about who is the one being divisive here?
Well, let's start at some basics here. I mean, the notion that Barack Obama is among the most divisive presidents that we have seen is utter nonsense. It's utter nonsense. I think this president, and I think I certainly did as Attorney General, we certainly, I think, extended our hands to try to work through things and were met with really kind of unprincipled opposition. It was all political.
I want to go back to 2009 when you said famously, though this nation has proudly thought of itself as an ethnic melting pot, in things racial we have always been, and we, I believe, continue to be in too many ways, essentially a nation of cowards. I want to ask what you think about that comment today. I wonder if you still believe it. And I do wonder if in some ways you think it was a mistake, because this is one of the things that's cited when people say that you and the president are unnecessarily divisive and polarizing.
Well, I think this is still a nation that is unwilling to confront its racial past, still feels uncomfortable dealing with our racial present, and is fearful of our racial future. So I think that what I said in that speech, and I think people need to read the entirety of that speech as opposed to just that phrase, because it's basically a pretty optimistic speech. But I think that too many people are still afraid of race and only deal with the issue when a racial issue flares up. There's a racial incident. Talk about it for whatever the minimal amount of time is. And then, as I said in this speech, everybody retreats to their racial cocoons and no real progress is made. So the fact that we are having these conversations, still not to the degree I think that we need to, but that we're having these conversations, that people are aware of racial issues, and that creates tension and friction. I think that's good tension. I think that's good friction. And, you know, you asked earlier, I mean, have we made progress? Well, I think, you know, one measure is what people say in opinion polls, but other ways of measuring progress is to look at programmatic things. If you look at where the criminal justice system is and where I think it's likely to be, substantial progress. You know, protecting voting rights. Again, I think as a result of things that have been done in the administration, we have taken it to as good a place as you can.
Okay, but this is outside of your particular area of expertise in your bailiwick, but the fact is, until this last election in Louisiana, no Democrat had won a statewide office in the South since this president took office, and Republicans now control more state houses today than they did when he took office. What
does
that suggest?
There's certainly been erosion there. But, you know, I'm not sure that looking at what happens in the South is necessarily a barometer of how well this president did or did not do. The South was lost to the Democratic Party, as Lyndon Johnson famously said back in the 60s. And you will see change gradually there. I mean, North Carolina, Georgia, there'll be other states that I think are going to be more purple than red.
In the time that we have left, I'd like to talk about the issue that I know is on a lot of people's minds, which is terrorism. Now that you've had a chance to think about it, given everything you saw, which is a lot more than most of us see, is there anything you changed your mind about over the course of time?
No, I'll tell you one thing. There needs to be an acknowledgement by those who opposed my decision to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in an Article III court and to try generally to use our Article III courts in the fight against terrorism, that those who opposed it have to say they were wrong. They were dead 100% wrong, and that I was right. You know, this notion that we're going to use military tribunals has proven to be totally ineffective. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who we could have tried in New York safely, would have been convicted, would be on death row right now, is still awaiting trial in Guantanamo. People have to remember the vehemence with which that decision was opposed. And I think all those people now who oppose that decision need to, you know, man up, woman up, and say, you know, we were wrong.
Is there anything you've changed your mind about, and how to address this, what has now become a worldwide problem?
No, I mean, I've certainly learned more, and I think that, you know, the notion of countering violent extremism by making sure that we reach out to Muslim communities is extremely important. I've learned that that's something that our allies have to do to a greater degree than they have done in the past. I remember sitting with the Belgian justice minister, a couple of years or so ago, and she said they had problems with regard to the number of people who were leaving that country and going to Syria, Iraq, and then coming back. And we now know proportionally that Belgium has the biggest problem in Europe in that regard. And to put programs in place to deal with the isolation that so many in those communities feel, especially in Europe. You know, that's something that I think we have learned that is really important to do. There has to be, again, a military component, but we also have to deal with these underlying reasons why people do these irrational and horrible things.
Do you have a candidate for president?
I'll probably be supporting Hillary Clinton. I sat with her in the Situation Room. I have seen her deal with the issues that are going to confront the next president. She's got the necessary experience. She's got great judgment. She will come to the job on day one, ready to do the job in a way that I don't think anybody else who is running for president on either side has the ability to do.
The Harvard Institute of Politics did a survey of millennials and their interest in politics and what they're thinking about right now. And what would you say to young people who say, I don't want to get chewed up like that. I just don't want to go through all that. What would you say?
Well, I'd say, first of all, I didn't get chewed up. I'm still here. I'm still standing. I'm still talking. I grew up in New York City, and I'd oftentimes sit there in these congressional hearings and say, is that it? Is that the best you got? I mean, you think you're getting me with this? You know, come on, really? And I was able to maintain my calm most of the time. And then every once in a while, somebody would say something, you know, truly idiotic or offensive, and I'd have my little mini holder explosion. So I would tell people that, you know, yeah, there's a price that you pay for engaging in public life. But unless people are willing to run the risk of getting, you know, chewed up, to use your phrase, progress doesn't really happen. And what I'd say to millennials is, unless, you know, you're prepared to put yourself out there, people who are less qualified, less committed, less idealistic will be the ones who will decide the fate of this country in the 21st century. And that's a bad thing.
Eric Holder is the former Attorney General of the United States. He was kind enough to host us in his offices in Washington, D.C., at Covington and Burling. Mr. Holder, Mr. Attorney General, thank you so much for speaking with us.
All right. I hope this is just the beginning of a series of conversations we'll have.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, December 12th, 2015. So, I have been told, no endorsements for Hillary Clinton here. Compensatory call-in. Feel free to chime in if you have thoughts you would like to share on any of the news clips, observations from the last 7 days. Certainly a lot of things to talk about, and we'll get to workplace racism a little bit down the road. The number to dial is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. The number again is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Invest in the program. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. You can hit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. You'll see the PayPal button in the top right corner. Again, listener-supported counter-racist radio. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email address and we will get you a physical mailing address. A couple quick things to point out before we get to some of the folks that dialed in. I can truthfully say I'm super glad that the Holtzclaw trial, at least this phase of it, is done. I'm tired of seeing his name. I'm tired of reading about him. I'm tired of seeing his face. All of that. I think some of that was extra because I wrote my article about this whole thing this week. One of the more popular pieces that I published this year. Thanks for the folks who shared. It's on the blog. Should be the top post up there. But I'm super glad all that is over so we can move forward and talk about other things. I don't have to hear his name as frequently or see his face. One point of caution that I would add, I did see, this is not necessarily Cal's listeners or anything, just in general, I did see a good bit of people who were, I guess for lack of a better word, celebrating or, you know, saying that this is great and they were pleased. I heard quite a few people, they were using the term justice, saying that justice was served. And I would certainly encourage caution for people to be very tempered in how they process all that, I guess for three reasons. Number one, and all three of these reasons should be weighed equally, in my opinion. For one, he was convicted of 18 counts. He was also found not guilty on 18 counts. That's number one. Even two of the first degree rape charges, he was found not guilty. So not all of the black females who were victimized by Holtzclaw, not all of them even got a conviction for the charges, the offenses, for their violation. And I'm sure this was said last year when he was first arrested that that there were probably other victims who just didn't step forward. I think they say that all the time. That's not even debated, that most of the people that are subjected to any sort of sexual abuse, sexual trauma, they don't come forward. And the way that these victims were shamed and the way that they were talked about from the beginning all the way through the trial, I could see why people might be intimidated to come forward to share this. So that's number one. Number two, I have seen too many instances where particularly enforcement officers, I would say white people in general, but especially enforcement officials, I've seen too many cases where they get convicted Maybe you go to court and you get a conviction. And I mean, even murder cases where you get a conviction. And then after some of the attention has died down, people aren't really, you know, looking at this every day. The trial is over. So people, you know, drift off to something, particularly after, you know, you get a conviction. You think, hey, this is great. We won this one. So we move on to something else. And then they will wait maybe four months, a year sometimes. And then they will say, "Whoop, wait a minute. We got a clerical error. Somebody forgot to staple a sheet of paper, so we got to vacate all these convictions." I have seen that happen a lot, and especially boldface, underline, I have seen that a lot, particularly when it is an enforcement officer, a white enforcement officer who has violated a black person, where they find some way to spring that person from greater confinement. I mean, that's all over Hurricane Katrina, where there were tons of officers who got convicted for murder charges and lying and all this stuff. And then somehow they overturned it. In a lot of those cases, they didn't just overturn it. They overturned it. The officers got reinstated. They got back pay. I have seen that happen over and over and over and over. Johann Messerly with the Oscar Grant case. So I would certainly, anything could happen with sentencing. His attorney, I think they had already said that he's going to appeal. So I would certainly exercise caution for that reason alone. In addition to the final reason, in my view, if we were really going to say justice, we want justice in this case, because that's what some people were saying. Justice would be, in addition to whatever, you know, punishment they heap on him, if he's in jail for the rest of his life, even if they executed him, it would also include restitution for the victims. How are we going to attempt to make these black females whole? And not just a paycheck, but I mean everything. We're going to make sure that they are totally straight. Anything that they need, make sure that their housing situation is straight. If they alleged a lot of these victims had substance abuse issues, let's make sure that they get any of the help that they need in dealing with that. And I mean the good stuff, like the rich white people get. Like, we are going to totally hook them up and make sure that they are straight. And this is going to be the turning point in their life where they get all of the help that they need. They are totally repaired. We're going to totally make them whole. I have seen none of that at all. In fact, I've seen tons on the comment section where white people continue to just blast them as whores and crackheads and liars, and they just conspired to ruin this man's life. I've seen tons of that. So that would be my word of caution. I don't see, you know, anything to celebrate. I guess it's, you know, not the worst day on the plantation to have him be convicted of 18 out of 36 counts, but we are still in the system. This is just one of many Holtzclaws, in my opinion, but certainly folks can offer their other opinions, thoughts on that. Also, wanted to make sure I got in as well. I had to unfortunately field questions this week about why. We were talking about Ta-Nehisi Coates, and he got referenced as a coon, or the term cooning was used. And I've, you know, been very clear in my stance on the use of that term. People who've been listening to this program for any length of time have, you know, consistently heard me encourage not name calling other black people, and certainly not using that type of language on the program. From this point forward, anytime that slips out, and people feel like that's the best word that they got to use to describe a black person, coon, any of the derivatives, any other name calling a black person, I'm just hitting the mute button. You have lost your privileges to speak on the program. I'm not doing any warnings, and I'm not doing any more of the after you get done. And even I try to be patient and wait till people finish, so I'm not interrupting them. That is out of the window. I'm totally done with that, particularly people who've been listening to the program. That day is done. If you need to call black people Sambos and coons and Uncle Toms and any other new ones that they come up with, cool in the gang. Find another program. If you think that's going to solve any problems, I have seen no evidence that sitting around name-calling black people solves any problems, improves things at all for black people. Maybe I'm wrong. If so, you can put Gus's name at the top of the list for Coon of the Year, Sambo of the Year. Fine. If I'm incorrect on that one, when you get your new program or whatever other project you need to do that, fine. Gus, Coon of the Year. No problem. Last thing before we get to some of the folks who dialed in. I also had a wave, and it was not just one person. It was quite a few people who were using the term like when they emailed, messaged, and it was a lot of people. I wouldn't have even said anything if it had just been one person, but it was quite a few people. I don't like Ta-Nehisi Coates, or I don't like this person. Just for the record, and this shouldn't be surprising, I don't like anybody. I am a very grumpy victim of racism. I have said that consistently throughout the years, almost seven of them that we've been doing the program, that I'm not a nice person, and I think I am known for saying on this program, if you like the program, so what? If you don't like the program, so what? Replace white supremacy with justice. And it's really, it's connected to code. It's not, it's more than just me being, you know, not that nice of a fella. It's really, it's not about, you know, do I like this person on a personal level because they're talking about racism and all that. I mean, certainly if people are doing constructive things, that's great. I'm certainly going to be a bit more pleased if somebody is doing something that is helping to solve this problem. But I really would encourage folks not to process and go about the business of racism, white supremacy from a stance of, well, I like this person, and that will be the basis for how we go about interacting or whether I listen to what they have to say. Really just focus on logical, constructive relationships with other people, not about like, and I mean, that's even flows into why I said, don't call me brother. I'm not into all that terminology. Let's just, we can be courteous. We can talk to one another without the name calling and bashing and all that. We can be kind to one another, but it's really not based in liking. There are tons of non-white people, tons of black people that we've had on the program that I've talked to down through the years, and I really appreciate and value their material, their contributions to solving this problem. That is not a, I like this person, or I don't agree with this person's assessment. We have come to different conclusions about racism, white supremacy. That doesn't mean that I don't like them. I don't know any of these people. Even let's take Dr. Welsing. I'm not hanging out with Dr. Welsing off the air, you know, watching television and eating crumpets and that sort of thing. No, it's just let's go about the business of racism. Even when I talk to Dr. Welsing off the air, it's, you know, business as usual. What's up with racism? What reports have you seen? Sharing information. That's the whole basis of it. In fact, it even reminds me of Dr. John Henry Clark. He was talking about Minister Malcolm X, and he said we had a relationship that was based on information, and that just really stuck with me. Like, wow, it wasn't I like him, he's a cool fella. It was, we are about solving problems for black people. That is, in my opinion, that is way more valuable than I like this person. And I would also just add, that is real fickle, because I have seen where people quote unquote like someone today, and then by Monday they don't like that person anymore. And that's just not the way that I process racism, white supremacy. Even if, you know, I've just used Dr. Welsing because I mentioned her before. If I never talk to Dr. Welsing again, she's like, the cows is whack. You all are retarded. Gus is retarded. And I'm never coming on your program again. Okay. Well, we did 30 programs with her. Great information. Appreciate the ISIS papers. And it really helped in clearing my confusion and just keep it pushing in that manner. That just wanted to make sure that is emphasized. And in fact, even that term, like, it is in the word guide. I think I've read it before where Mr. Fuller suggests not using that word when talking about people and saying that you like Jane or you like Sally. It's pretty detailed in terms of him explaining his thoughts on that term, but I would encourage folks to check it out if you have a word guide. That said, we will get to the folks who dialed in. The number again, 641-715-3640, and the code 564-943-pound. Justice says hi. I don't like her either. Everyone who dialed in who has a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
How you doing? This is my first time calling in. I've been listening to the show for a little while, and it's something that stuck with me, like, on some of your older episodes. There was one when I think you were still in college, and there was an Asian female, and they did something with one of her pictures, and she was in a, she had a program with a white person, and she said something, and she said that racism, it, on the individual level, sometimes it breaks down, and I noticed that sometimes in myself and people, Africans that I interact with, that it, on a personal level, it breaks down to them, and it's like, that's where the group dynamics seems to, like, the aspect of understanding a group and a person seems to get lost in the shuffle, and it seems like, even though we have a lot of differences, black people, African people, we all have something that's very similar, and it's the way that we interact inside of the system, and it's just very peculiar.
Good to hear. First time caller. Great to have you finally be able to participate. Just for folks who are confused, I don't know, it's Christine Tran, I think, is the program that he's talking about, where she was on the broadcast, 2010, if memory serves, at the beginning of the year. And she was doing a different radio program, not the Cow. She was co-hosting with a suspected white supremacist. And I think the genre or the main theme of their program was around sex. It was a college radio program, so they were talking to students at the University of Washington around issues dealing with sex. And they had on the University of Washington Daily newspaper, they had a photograph of her talking about this radio program dealing with sex. And in my opinion, it to me looked very much engineered and deliberately had the microphone and the photograph framed in a way to make it look like she had a huge phallus in front of her face. And I just thought, and this is a non-white female, so I thought, here we go again. And this is a non-white female, so-called Asian, the whole Asian geisha thing and super hyper sexualization of Asian females, right in with the Holdsclaw case as well. And I pointed this out, and she said that she didn't think about it in that way when she first saw the paper. She was just really excited and on the front page of the paper and getting promotion for the program. And then when I said something about it, she was like, oh, I do see that. That does make sense. And we talked about all this on the program, but that's the one that he's referencing, where she, and even within that context, in terms of those breakdowns, where you can understand, we non-white people, victims of racism, can understand white supremacy, but at times you can have breakdowns where you don't really see how it's impacting you on an individual level, or how it's how an individual white person is practicing racism around you. You have those breakdowns. Is that what you were referencing, sir?
Yes, that's exactly it. It seems like that's an aspect that a lot of African people have, because it's easy to speak about it as a something other than being closely associated to you, like the average person, because we interact with so many whites. So now, like, it's hard not to. So some of them, obviously, like you've spoken about on the program multiple times, white friends, what does that even mean? I guess it's someone that doesn't call you, like, a nigger to your face, or something. I guess, like, that that's the breakdown, the not being insulted, not being physically attacked. So it seems like that person is not operating inside of the system, but you don't leave it once you're classified as white. You're classified as white. You don't leave the aspects of it.
Right. Just for folks, she was not, I've never heard her classified as an African. I said she's so-called Asian, so it would seem that all victims of racism have a tendency to have these quote-unquote breakdowns. Great.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir. Thomas in New York. Go ahead.
Good evening to all. Good evening, Gus. I remember that show. Yeah, it's a good show. I think this was a excellent week for counter-racist observations, and I made a few. My main white supremacist, Donald Trump, was on his white supremacy job this week, and this is why I thought it was such an excellent week. Have to tip my hat to him for making white Americans and the white political establishment break cold. For context, he spoke about, well, I don't think I was calling in then, but I was corresponding with via email, but the Donald Sterling holds conversation. And if y'all remember, when they put that microphone in front of Mark Cuban's face, he didn't break cold. You know, he was, hey, he's an owner, he can do what he wants to do. You know, he didn't break cold. you know, stuck to the code. But after Trump's latest racist scout, you know, first it was the Mexicans, but this time with the comment about the Muslims, I've never seen more prominent white men call another white man a racist on television in my life. I mean, I was just like sitting there with my mouth open. As for his comments, man, I think they were genius. You know, people are saying he's a fear-mongerer. And white people are not fear-mongerers. You know, I don't think white people fear anything but genetic annihilation. And they don't directly admit to that. They have a code and they have institutions in place to deal with that. But they don't fear people they dominate, you know, and people that they made up, like the Arabs. You know, so I think what he's doing is just strategically positioning a white general public to all agree that they're victims. And victims of radical Islam terrorists, it's just genius, man. He's working like a charm. His fold up and jump up dramatically. You know, victims of Mexican rapists, once again, his fold up and jumped up in. I mean, it's beautiful. And once again, our correspondent to tell me, who convinced all the white South Carolinians they were about to be victims of black domination. I mean, they all fell right in line. Tactic proven to work. White people got them talking honestly. It got the media. They don't know what to do. I just been cracking up all week. I thought it was great. And also, the comments about Scalia. I saw Harry Reid come on and said this one, called him a racist. And I said, wow, this is beautiful. Of course, you played the clip about what he thought, and you know, that was what my observation was. And you kind of touched on this, you know, I call it half justice, and is half justice better than no justice? You know, whether we don't get justice or just receive half justice in this system, you know, that's how it plays out for us. We either get one or the other. You know, the radical rapist, terrorist, Daniel Holtzler turned out to be a big old crybaby. He can keep his tears and whimpers. I ain't praying for him. I hope he dies in jail very painfully. But the point I want to make is that it's absolutely, we can never get absolute or complete justice in this system. You know, we only can get half justice. And an all-white jury, you know, white people are not ignorant. The logic in all this is in the system, where we constantly see the bond between police and prosecutors is seemingly unbreakable, and police practice the glass shield, you know, they don't tell on each other. No investigator is going to come forth without sound evidence. No prosecutor is going to put a false victim before a jury to convict a cop. You know, no cop force is going to fire a cop and make public statements against the cop before a trial. Unless they have 100% undocumented evidence that this person's guilty. The union even said they're not going to help them get paid for their defense. And we still have only 18 out of 36 accounts. That's half justice. There's no way they shouldn't have got all 36 accounts. And if they come back with the thing where they just give him the 30 years and he has to do, there's a possibility out of 260-something years, he only has to do 22. I could see that still happening. Quickly on the clips, New Jersey, it says 75% of the black residents statewide live on a contaminated site. And I like to tell y'all that I'm from Jersey, and all the whites that live on contaminated sites only live on them sites because they agreed to get away from black people. And they didn't care if the site was contaminated or not. One side of Jersey City, you got the picturesque New York skyline. You know, the green statue of oppression sitting there in the Hudson River. And if you look at the other side, you got the North Bay. And the skyline is huge gas tankers with thick clouds of white smoke coming out of them and old factories with black smoke coming out of them. And the water is contaminated. It has, like, this glowing stuff in it. I mean, and you have this smell that will come across the air that smelled like burning yellow cheese. And, you would have to call. And once you made a call, they would put another smell, like the coated, like a strawberry-type smell. And, you know, just terrible. And, Jersey is toxic. And where the blacks live, the worst parts, trust me. The Post of People's racist comments, great idea. You know, I mean, I could see that working for public officials and things, but, you know, whites would quickly hear if they tried that. You know, they'll very codifiedly and quickly claim that people are violating their freedom of speech and become victims and get rid of that fast. You know, that's clip where you, this is the last more comment I want to make very quickly. The description, put a description on a statue to educate people about they were slave owners or their white terrorism. That's a solution. Like, that's such a white supremacist ideal. White people get a thrill out of that. It's like the books they write, thoroughly describing their terrorism. You know, it just be, I mean, those descriptions would be so detailed. Oh, he did this. So 300 Negro, I mean, it'll just be so detailed, and they'll be taking pictures in front of it like crazy. I'll mute my line.
Right on, right on. Make sure I get in before all the other folks who have a hand up can comment. But the Holtzclaw trial, lots of our listeners, Thomas in New York included, did fantastic work in sharing material. I said the article I wrote on Holtzclaw was one of the more popular ones that I wrote this year. Part of that was because I got great content, reference material from our listeners. Some of them even called multiple, not just one person. They called the Oklahoma County Court to get information and trial dates when they moved the trial from October to November, and just really stayed on that case from day one back in August of last summer when he was arrested all the way through the conviction. Just did a fantastic job. Listeners were really on that one. I said at the beginning of the year, I thought this was a case that we should be paying attention to and should not be forgotten. And folks did an outstanding job sharing material. So kudos to all the folks who have shared and given out information and just done great work on this case for about the last, 14 months, year and a half or so. Everybody else who dialed in with a hand up, the line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, because how you doing? And to the rest of the people. I was looking at, I was reading the papers online, and I saw another case. It was interesting that there was a case, I think it was in Colorado Springs, when they had this 57-year-old white man who went into this abortion clinic. I think his name was Robert Lewis Deere. He had shot and killed a white police officer and three other people, and he wounded nine people, and he shot it out with police. I guess he had AK-47, and he was not, when they caught him, he was not shot, killed, beaten, or referred to as a terrorist. Now, I compare his case to the boy in Chicago. You know, you had the guy, young boy in Chicago, who was shot 16 times and didn't even have a gun. Only thing he did was wave his hands up in the air and was shot 16 times, which it doesn't surprise me under white supremacy. And also, too, the case with Daryl Holtzclaw. You know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think that had Daryl Holtzclaw would have been a full white man, you know, a two white parents, had he been as white as Jared Fogel from Subway or Ben Roethlisberger, I think they'd have probably given him less time. They would have jumped all over the insanity defense. They'd have been making all kind of excuses for him. They said, oh, he's mentally ill. He doesn't need all that time. He needs therapy. He needs some kind of treatment, you know, but, you know, since he's, you know, I thought maybe because he was Asian, you know, since he's not white, they threw the book at him. And under the system of racism and white supremacy, I always say to myself, one thing I learned about this system is that when it comes to people of color, this system takes no prisoners. If you are a person of color, you know, like I always tell people, you know, if you're black and you go out and harm another black person, they're going to get you. You know, one goes to prison, one goes to jail. But had he been, how this compares to Holtzclaw, had he been a white police officer, they'd have made all kinds of excuses. They probably would have reduced this sentence to 5 years. You know, like I agree with you said, when they probably let him off on a technicality. That's all I have to say.
Right on. Other folks who had a hand up who we haven't heard from yet, feel free to chime in. Making sure I did not botch the lines. I thought I had opened them.
Daniel, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Dear to you guys and to all the callers and listeners, this is Rosh. And, actually, just to touch base on something that Thomas in New York said in regards to changing the plaques at these different sites where they can commemorate racist people in history and racist commemorate racist events. I just believe that those things would just be, just like him, I think he's absolutely right. It would be a beacon to white supremacists. They tend to worship places where massive amounts of death happen. You know, you look at the reenactment of Gettysburg and all these things that they do to this day, just to reenact death and destruction. I think that's really what they worship. And in order to get the biggest bang for their buck, I think commemorating sites where they desecrate black people would be the most prominent places as far as the places that they visit. So I totally agree with everything that Thomas said earlier. And also, I found it interesting, the clip that you played about Brazil and racism in Brazil. My studies, and as a person of Caribbean descent, I know quite a few people from different so-called Latin American and Spanish-speaking Caribbean countries. And what I find is, as confusing as racism can be for English-speaking black people, whether they're Caribbean descent, African descent, or American African descent, I find that Spanish-speaking people of African descent, or Spanish-speaking people, period, to me have the most confusing system of racial identification. And just based on some of the conversations that I've had with different people about race and some documentaries I've seen on it, I just think that they probably have the most intimate and acute form of confusion in regards to racial identification and understanding what it means to be white, just from what I've seen in my studies. And there's a couple of great documentaries on that. One was Black in Latin America that was done by Henry Louis Gates, and another one was called Brazil, with a white guy named Michael Palin, where he travels throughout Brazil and gives information on the history of Africa and its influence on Brazilian culture and history. Then I thought about the clip that you played, I believe it was from South Africa, and the reporters talked about people in South Africa, just in general, I'm assuming, the black African, South African public, having little trust in different ethnic groups. And what I thought about was just how white supremacy can breed acute xenophobia by turning groups of people who may have been known to live side by side for thousands of years without any sort of problems of violence or conflict between those groups. And as soon as white people come into the picture and they take over, they enslave, brutalize these people, and recreate their country's borders, that once they become, I would say, proxy racist by distance, meaning that they might live back in their European countries, but they have puppet rulers and puppet politicians that they actually utilize to perpetuate white supremacy with a face that looks like the oppressed people that they're basically abusing. I think that's exactly what white supremacy breeds, is just that acute distrust and dislike of other people that are non-white, even those people who have gotten along for thousands of years without any sort of problems. And I remember there was a guy she interviewed, I think his name was Fando. I don't remember how to say it, what his last name was, so I don't want to mispronounce it. But I remember he was saying that South Africa's political system is basically a byproduct of apartheid, white supremacy, and South Africa must start a new system based on justice, and essentially that they should not be a part of a system that is not based on African growth and development, which I wholeheartedly agree with, and basically speaks to a lot of what Neely Fuller talks about, and it's basically replacing white supremacy with a system of justice. There's, again, Thomas Smith also mentioned this earlier, too. There is nothing that we can get as far as justice and reciprocity and true equality between people in this system. Malcolm X said it as well. Minister Malcolm X said the same thing. We would have to totally annihilate the system that exists today and rebuild it based on something else that is balanced and that provides justice and reciprocity between all people. And I think that that's probably the biggest fear, but there's a lot of research I've done, and I've talked to a lot of African traditional priests and other indigenous spiritual people, and a lot of them have always said that until we start to go back to our indigenous traditions, our spirituality, and our culture, that is the key to eradicating the assembly of white supremacy. Because basically, if you look at African culture, it is the direct equal opposite of white supremacy. And as a result, that is what they eradicated first through the destruction of culture and, of course, religion, which, of course, I agree with Dr. John Henry Clark. He said that religion is the deification of culture. And that's really what I find to be essentially true. And for us, that's what we would have to do is somehow update our ancestral systems and ways of doing things between ourselves and one another in order to create a system that is more balanced and just amongst all people. And there's a couple other clips. I don't know if you saw it today. I just wanted to mention this on C-SPAN. They had a really good hour and a half, I guess you could say, roundtable discussion on Stokely Carmichael, and they discussed his growing up in Trinidad, moving to the United States, and his work in SNCC in great detail. They actually had Charles Popp on the roundtable. He's the guy who you interviewed a few years back who wrote the book, That Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. And he had some of the most profound insights, and they had quite a few people in the audience that actually knew Stokely Carmichael very well, who had a lot of profound gaps to fill in on understanding just how important he is and how white supremacy has marginalized him and his ideas simply because of basically how radical they were and how insightful they were as far as fighting the system of white supremacy. And I don't know if you saw, but I know on the East Coast it's supposed to come on again on C-SPAN between 4 and 5:30 in the morning on C-SPAN. But it was basically called Stokely Carmichael, and it's a really, really good roundtable discussion. It includes Charles Kyven, about, I think, four other people speaking about him, some of which knew him, and Charles Kyven was one of them. He worked with him as well. And you also played a clip, I think it was about in Memphis, there was someone who was speaking about shining the light of truth on the painful past of yesterday, and also basically how white supremacy functions today. And I just thought about your show being one of those ever-shining lights on racism, white supremacy, which I agree with you is the most important issue that's facing humanity and our ability to relate to one another. And I'm really glad that you're showing this simply because it's so important for us to continue to shine that light. The work you've done to facilitate staying focused on Daniel Holt's Haunted Child was really great, and I thank you for all the work that you do. And it was something that I caught, too, in the newly Fuller clip that spoke of an unwritten law that white men cannot rape a black woman, that black people would be arrested for false charges, for making false charges in regards to the rape of a black female by a white male. And I just see how that plays out today. Is we just call it tragic arrangement. But it's basically exactly what it is a voluntary form of rape. You're volunteering yourself to be raped. And I saw something I'll discuss during workplace racism in regards to just that concept. But it's exactly what's happening today. Even with the Daniel Holt School Child, a good example of them trying to get away with that again. And I agree with you, we need to be very cautious because the system can overturn it, and he can walk like nothing happened. So I totally agree with you as far as remaining on alert in regards to that. And also, I just wanted to know if you got the documentary that I emailed you, the one on Peter Tosh, Larry Davis, and the Patrice Lumumba story. And that's it. Thank you.
Yes, I did receive them. Thank you kindly.
Okay, no problem. Thank you very much.
For sure. Anybody that we have not heard from that wanted to share, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace to everybody. Peace to Gus. And good evening, all. I found many, many of your clips very, very stimulating, but there was one in particular I'm actually writing right now, and it when it came on, I stopped because it was describing something which I was talking with a friend about earlier in the week. I believe it was dealing with South Africa, but the woman was speaking about, or the man, excuse me, I believe was speaking about owning institutions, and he mentioned churches and schools and what have you, and I, it just so happens I was speaking with an ex-military person earlier this week who was talking to me about the oddity of justice in America, which he has concluded is fascistic. But he grew up down south, and he has walked through many of the great black institutions, which we think about, Howard being one of them, of course. And he said he's also been to Harvard and to some of these other great white institutions. And his quote to me was, one does not hold the candle to the other. It is incredible to actually see that in this age when separate but equal is defeated, or supposedly defeated, these entities could exist as they do. Howard, which is considered probably the most prominent black education institution in this country, is, quote, a dump compared to Howard. It doesn't hold a single light to it. Yet, from that, we are still able to build ourselves up. What does that say about our ingenuity? I think that what was stated in that clip, that we do have to build institutions, I think that is the future, which white people are now trying to grapple with. Because as I stated a couple of weeks ago, there was an article on the front page of the business section of the New York Times, which said that this one, it followed this woman who was trying to buy solely from black businesses. And I truthfully looked at that as a nod to financial institutions to start investing, maybe not heavily, but some money in putting black faces on some of the most degrading businesses that white people want to offer us. I know there are many of those that already exist, but I'm thinking there will be a bit more to try to stymie what is definitely growing on social media as this push to buy from black people and to create a more interrelated relationship between black people. I don't believe we have to disagree or that we would disagree that interrelation between black people are and have been just temporarily shattered, and we need to resurrect that. So, again, that stood out for me, and I want to thank you for playing that. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Any of the other folks that we have not heard from, feel free to chime in if we haven't heard from you.
Good evening, everyone. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. First, I wanted to start off with a question for you, Gus, or any of the other callers or listeners, if they can answer. What is the significance of using the term black bodies instead of, black males or black females? I just noticed that a lot of people are using it, and I was just trying to understand if, you know, I could be a little slow. Also, I wanted to just note that, you know, listening to your opening comments, Gus, talking about, you know, people liking people, which is a big thing. And it's kind of, I've just been sitting back thinking, like, I've been trying to be more codified myself and trying to, you know, be constructive when I am dealing with other people, just people in general, especially non-white people, black people in particular. But it's really hard. I'm wondering, like, particularly we have, you know, I'm looking at, like, hip-hop, which, you know, I really grew up listening to, and I don't listen to it as much anymore, but it's like we can spread culture, or we can spread things through hip-hop where from the youngest of people will start using terms and start doing things, you know, like, you know, get money or, you know, just certain, you know, most of the stuff is it's not constructive, but we can spread stuff from the youngest all the way to, you hear like 70 or 80 year old people starting to take on stuff from hip hop or something that, you know, the young kids are doing. It's like, how can we really start being codified or start changing our culture? Like, do we have to do it through like a method like a medium like hip hop? Like, you know, is that how more people can be codified, is if, you know, because that seems like the, I don't want to say the only way that especially black people start taking on stuff or really like, oh, this is the new movement and stuff. Otherwise, it's like, it's really hard for people to grasp stuff. We're still stuck on non-constructive things, man. It's like, that's our, you know, because of course, white people are to blame. I agree, but we're just so stuck on it. And the only time we really start grabbing a hold of stuff is, I don't know, through hip-hop and through social media now. But that's all I have for now. I do want to share something for workplace racism. Thank you.
I appreciate it. The bodies point, if other people have comments on that, they can feel free to give their view as well.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I was going to say, in relation to the black bodies term, I think my feeling is, and the way I would use it would be to refer to the difference in the treatment of the bodies of black people. And it's almost like a way of making it more universal to all black people, in my opinion, because if you look at the way black people are treated, or the black body is treated versus the white body, even historically and in contemporary times, we have always been objectified. We've had our women's genitals cut out and placed on display, non-burial of people who have been abused, going back to Sarah Bartman, we can go to Oda Benga. I mean, there's so many ways in which the black body has been so severely disrespected that compared to the white body, in which Dylan Stormwood can go and murder 9 black people in cold blood and get a burger and a bulletproof vest, you know, and Rodney King can just basically try to outrun the cops and get his behind handed to him. So, I mean, it's basically referring to that treatment, that severe brutality that's afforded to the black body. I just saw some information earlier today about there being information that Tamir Rice had his hands in his pocket and not even on this fake weapon at the time he was shot, which really speaks volumes to the fact that black children are not treated as children in this society. So when the use of the term black body just means, in my opinion, the fact that our bodies are always subject to brutality, and it's normalized, and it's made to be something that is just a white right, versus the white body being treated with such dignity and high respect, even for people who commit the most heinous crime known to man. And that's my opinion. Thank you.
Hello?
Yes, M1, go ahead.
Oh, hey, how's it going?
Just a couple of quick things. One, try not to go out because there's something called SantaCon, which is basically just another excuse for white people and unfortunately some non-white people who are following white people to get drunk. They dress up in Santa suits, elf suits, wear red, whatever. They go bar hopping. So try and stay away from any bar. And also, to all the people, the sisters that were on your show, to Thomas from New York and others who put in the work to make people aware of Daniel Holtzclaw, the white rapist just convicted. You know, that all this is good also. You know, because as we know historically, a black female says she is raped, is just dismissed. And so to have this guy convicted and hopefully getting a long sentence is good. Oh, and Gus, last week you mentioned a white guy from Ohio who you said dispatcher dismissed when he was walking around with a firearm, and he ended up killing three people. Do you know what his name was?
It was in Colorado. If you give me a moment, I can find it.
Oh, was that Robert Louis Deer?
It was not the Planned Parenthood shooting. This was like a month or so before that.
Oh, okay. Oh, I think that may have been Noah Hoffman. I think of a Hoffman. Also, speaking of, this is my last point. Speaking of Robert Louis Deer, the Planned Parenthood shooter, you know, he was a twofer. Not only was he a terrorist, and he wasn't referred to as a terrorist for the most part. Once again, in spite of him shooting five cops, killing one of them, I saw no one calling this a war on cops. I saw this guy, CNN analyst, Harry Howe, who is always on the TV every time a black person is accused of killing a cop. He's always talking about the rhetoric that gets police officers wrong. Blames Sharpton. Blames Obama. Blames Black Lives Matter. Well, 2 days after this white man shoots five cops, killing one of them, he chooses to talk about the firing of Chicago police chief. No mention of his fallen brethren, his wounded brethren. 2 weeks have passed. No Blue Lives Matter rally in Colorado Springs like they did in Texas when Black Shannon Miles was accused of killing that white cop. Now, this is what I've seen. Again, I always ask, has any media in anybody else's area called what he did a war on cops? And that's all.
It was, you were correct, Noah Hartman, the white male shooter. This, again, is not the Planned Parenthood attack, but Noah Hartman was the name of the white shooter in Colorado who had his firearm. A white woman called 911, and she got a lecture that, you know, hey, this is open carry. Don't be calling, harassing us, these calls about white people going out exercising their Second Amendment rights. And then he went on to kill three people. I think all three of the people were non-white as well, just, you know, to add to the injury and horror of all of this. But Noah Hartman, you were correct, sir. That was his name. I guess I'll give my thought really quick, the body thing. Some of that is in the book we just read, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and the emphasis on black bodies. Some of that is in the book that we're reading right now, that we started yesterday, Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told. And the reason that, but in fact, in that book, each of the chapters of the book is titled after a part of the body specifically. And the reason that he does, even though I've only read the first with you all about the first 70 pages of the book, but it's done, I think, in both books. And I do think that this is very constructive. It's done to emphasize that we're not talking in an abstract way. We're not talking about white privilege, and we're not trying to make this some sort of esoteric conversation about oppression. We're talking about the mutilation of black bodies and how racism, white supremacy, white people, what they do, how it impacts black people on a very physical level. Just in the book, from The Half Has Never Been Told, from what we talked about yesterday, where he goes into, the first chapter is titled Feet. Then he goes into detail about all the walking black people had to do while they were enslaved, with 20 pounds worth of shackles on them and no shoes. He even goes into how many steps you would be required to take if you're going to walk, if you are being forced to walk from Texas to Louisiana or Virginia to Kentucky or wherever you know, happen to be going, and being forced to work outside in the snow with no shoes on. Just to really make this very clear, very plain, so that we can grasp the impact of terrorism on black people, males and females. I say that as well, black males, black females being mistreated, but specifically to say black bodies, how this impacts, how what white people does impacts us, to make it visceral, so that it's not just something that we are talking about in a really loose way. It's the, oh yeah, the suppression is really bad and this sort of thing, but just to really narrow it down in terms of the impact of what white people are doing, if that's clear.
I definitely, I understand that. It was just, I'm just thinking, like, if you're discussing it with other black people and you're using that term, that'll even, I guess, I don't know, desensitize us even more to where we're not even seeing the, you know, the abuse that we're taking. It's just black body. I get it, but at the same time, I can see how it's just, oh, black bodies, like, you know, the human element is kind of taken out of it. So I guess I can see, you know, both ways how that works. But thanks for explaining. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other folks have comments they want to make? We are closing on, I just want to say we're closing on workplace racism. We're closing on workplace racism. So if people have things they want to share that are not related to workplace racism, you should not dally. Go ahead and get your hand up. Whoever the person that was going to comment, feel free. I thought I'd heard someone. Was someone going to comment?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. My phone was muted. Thomas Smith from New York again. I just wanted to make a comment, too. You know, as far as hip-hop goes, you know, to me, hip-hop was one of the most counter-racist and revolutionary acts black people ever did when it first started. And, you know, it codified us in a language, in a dress code, in the way we carried ourselves, and the way we acted. And it was very pro-black. You know, we walked around with the most black, you know, every shirt we had was Malcolm, Martin, Marcus, our African medallions, you know, and then corporations took that away from us, you know, and started paying these people to make the music they make today. But one of the things that, you know, the guy was saying, you know, hip-hop has been corrupted. And if you look at it from that angle, you know, I think that you can reach people by showing them the corruption that happened. You know, I was talking to another guest, a person that calls into the show. We met face to face, and we were talking about hip hop. And I was telling him, I remember a time when you didn't use nigga or bitch in your rhyme at all. Those words were not used at all. And then, you know, some things happened, and then now every song is so derogatory. But it was a point in time where that was not accepted at all. And even when it first came out, those songs were not played here in New York. You know, we would call it like, all they do is curse. You know, that's whack. You know, it was all about the lyricism. It was about Public Enemy. You know, like, listen to that type of hip-hop and get a gist of what it really was and what it really stood for. It was the ultimate form of counter-racist thing that we've done probably since the Reconstruction, you know, since Black Wall Street and stuff. I mean, it was actually something that was really good and positive, and that's why they had to corrupt it. I mute my mom.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
No, stay back again.
Oh, hang on 1 second. Was the caller? I'll make sure you get an opportunity to comment, sir.
Okay.
The caller at 5640. Did you have something you wanted to make sure you got in? 5640.
I think I have a workplace.
Oh, your volume is really low. We can barely hear you. I thought you said you were calling in for workplace racism, though, if I heard you. Okay. Your volume is really, really low, though. I can, like, barely hear you if you can get it worked out. But workplace racism, we'll make sure we get you. The male caller who just spoke, if you want to go ahead with your thought.
Yeah, there was a time when Frances Cress Loveland was on the show, and she was speaking about ISIS when this movement first started. And she was saying that they were using it somewhat to, I don't know if she said it in these terms, but to discredit her or something like that. As if they were linking it to her. It's just, I was reading The Guardian a few days ago, and they had an article, and it was literally called The ISIS Papers. Leaked documents show how ISIS is building its state, and I just thought about her book, and I don't believe in coincidences. That, it was just so peculiar. It's just very peculiar.
I will definitely try to put my hands on that and send it to her. I would love to hear her thoughts on that. Folks have anything else they want to make sure they got in before workplace racism? No, folks are satisfied. The person that was asking about the black bodies, if you're listening to the book study session, I would definitely say you can pay attention to that to see if it desensitized, if you feel like it's detaching and you're not really thinking of black people as human beings, males and females that are going through this suffering. If you read Between the World and Me, that's another one you can pay attention. The context in my writing or speech when I'm using it, or anybody else, you can just pay attention and point out if you think it's distancing from thinking of black human beings being abused and terrorized. I can say from the Coates book, even though I certainly have my criticisms, which I shared there, I didn't get that sense of it being something that was distancing. That was one of the constructive aspects that I thought of the book in terms of deliberately framing it as this is how racism impacts black people. And it's a little early. I'll have to reserve. It's a bit too early for the half has never been told. We haven't even read a full chapter of that yet, so I'll have to reserve judgment on that one.
Well, I think black bodies is accurate because it kind of describes the way they look at us. And I think from the book meeting last night, you spoke a little bit about how the people had to walk for miles with pounds of chains on them, with no shoes, over the Blue Ridge Mountains even. I mean, I've been to Virginia and seen the Blue Ridge Mountains, and I couldn't imagine. And, you know, they were just bodies. You know, they were able to do a job. They had to go out and work with, you know, in the snow, I think you said, even
in the snow with no shoes on. You know, it didn't matter about the human aspect of that person. They were a body. And I think sometimes, like you said, don't, instead of saying Black Lives Matter, you should be saying Black Lives Don't Matter, because that's the truth. The truth is, in this system, we're just bodies. We're not people. And I think Neil Fuller says it all the time. There's no black men or women in this system of white supremacy. It's just black bodies. I mean, mom.
Yeah, I agree that that white people look view it as, you know, black bodies. But I'm just, you know, it's just for me, I'm just kind of questioning. I just noticed the term being used a lot more, I don't know, recently. And I was just wondering, like, even with if like black people or non-white people are speaking to other non-white people, are they getting that? Are they understanding that, or are they just looking at it as, you know, just black bodies? It's, you know, they, the human element is taken out of it. But again, you know, it's just something I was just wondering why it's being used a lot lately. But I can see, you know, what everyone is saying. But for me too, at the same time, wondering if other people, especially people that are more confused, like, do they see it as that way, or, you know, so that's all I have.
I do think also, even Coates' book, that, you know, I've read the whole thing, and Edward Baptiste's book, he is a white man, a racist suspect. I don't think it's exclusive. I think it's black male, black female, black people specifically, and then actually reading some of the black people's narratives, writing about what they experienced during formal plantation slavery and other aspects of white supremacy. I don't think it's certainly not exclusive, so you wouldn't just be seeing black body. It's not the only way it would be presented, so I don't think that would be just, you would have a very rigid presentation using that sort of terminology. Folks that have any other comments, make sure we catched everything before we get to workplace racism.
Gus, I wanted to speak on the hip hop thing too. I just see how, I mean, it's so powerful. Like, and I'm just wondering, is there a way that, you know, non-white people, particularly black people, can turn it back around again? Because, I mean, it's powerful. The most negative stuff can spread throughout, you know, not even just non-white people, just everyone. White people, you know, everyone saying nigger, and everyone saying these, you know, non-constructive, like, phrases, that it'll spread like that from the youngest to the oldest. You have a four-year-old saying it and doing it, the dances. And it's just so powerful, and it's like, man, can we flip that back again somehow? Like, is that the medium we have to? I don't know. It's just something I'm thinking. Like, you know, it's used to spread the negative stuff now so easily. It's been taken over, of course, by, you know, racists, I'm sure. But man, could it get turned back around? I don't know, the quote-unquote grassroots, I don't know, from people, can it be, you know, utilized again to everyone's advantage to become more codified and change from such a non-constructive culture to a constructive culture? But, you know, that's all I was just thinking.
I think it's been a lot of people that have attempted to use black music, even if you want to use the term quote-unquote hip-hop, but just black music, period, in a constructive way. In this system, white people are not going to give that the same rotation that you're going to get for all the stuff that is not constructive and encouraging abusive language, abusive behavior that's going to get you in contact with Daniel Holtzclaw. I think we've had Aisha Sekhmet. She's been on the program multiple times. That was exactly what she said, and trying to use her skill and music to talk about constructive things, talk about racism, white supremacy, and what we can do to try to solve problems. And she was saying the same thing, not getting the same type of distribution, not getting the same access as artists who are doing non-constructive things. And I think it's a long history. Even Dead Prez, I remember them talking openly about saying, hey, they would go to concerts and it would be all white people. White people have a hand in that, too. So I think you run into a lot of the same problems trying to do constructive things, trying to solve this problem. You run into the same opposition, number one, white people, but a lot of the same obstacles that, you know, folks that are trying to do other things, trying to use other mediums to solve this problem and address racism, white supremacy. A lot of those same problems still exist. I don't see hip hop being any different in that respect.
I think it just goes back to black people owning their own thing. When we had our own, when we had black baseball, or you had the black basketball association prior to the NBA, we tend to abandon our own things to, just to get in with white approval and white validation. I think Thomas Smith speaks about that regularly. It's really something where we drop the things that help us in the most constructive ways that are basically by us and for us in order to basically ride the bus with white people and drink from the same fountain. And that's been our downfall, essentially. It's just attaching ourselves to this system. And now it's become our umbilical cord, and it's the umbilical cord that's wrapped around our neck and has been for 500 years. And I just think it goes back to us owning our own things, owning our own radio stations, our own TV stations, and being able to propagate our own media and our own entertainment for our people. And I just don't think we have that sort of Pan-African, holistic, communal mentality. We've been now beaten and bred for 500 years to think of ourselves only, and white people think of us collectively. So you have two groups of people, one in dominance that looks at all other people who are not like them as the enemy, and then you have the people who they have abused and subjugated looking at them as individuals, and they collectively abuse us all every day and individually abuse us all every day. So I just think it just comes back to us going back to our own ideal, having a really broad, global, Pan-African scope in the effects of our cultural behavior, and trying to shift the consciousness first educationally, trying to spread the knowledge and understanding of racism and white supremacy and how it relates to our ancient and recent and contemporary history, and being able to establish our own institutions. It's basically what the brother in South Africa was talking about, us eradicating their system and replacing it with something else that is conducive to our growth and our development in all 10 areas of people activity.
Right on. With that, we will go ahead and hit workplace racism. Workplace racism, that was a pretty big metaphor there. If we had been earlier, I would have said a little bit more about that, the umbilical cord and all that. I guess I would just close with this. I haven't really seen any evidence that just black people having their quote-unquote own business, that is going to inoculate us from racism, white supremacy. But we can bring that up when we have more time later on. At any rate, workplace racism. Folks have things they would like to share. 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Folks have commentary on workplace racism.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, super. Thank you. Workplace racism. This is from Thanksgiving, but I couldn't, I work like from the time I had to leave, hurry up so I could participate in the program as far as talking. So this is from Thanksgiving. I had to work on Thanksgiving, and I had dinner at the home that I work at for Thanksgiving, and a lot of people didn't come because of the people that were going to attend. So it was just myself and my son and the people that live in the home and the Caucasian ex-wife and her son. She has a son with another victim. He's an adult now, but he brought his girlfriend, and she's Caucasian. So it's two Caucasians and then us. So I never pay her any attention, but I'll speak. You know, she speaks. I think she opened the door, so I spoke. And but I don't look at her because there's no need. You know, hi, she knows I'm talking to her. So
anything that I would do, she would just be, oh, she's so cute. And I'm just like, oh, my God. So then just anything I would say, it's just like, oh, she, listen to her. She's so smart. She's so cute. So they offered me alcohol, and I'm at work, so I can't drink. So I said, well, I don't want to lose my job. I can't drink. You guys will have me fired. And then so the Caucasian lady said, very smart woman. So I said, yeah. And so we're just echoing through the evening, and I noticed the Caucasian date, the girlfriend, she, everyone's under the influence in the home of alcohol except for me and my son and the elderly client. And so the Caucasian, the younger Caucasian, the girlfriend, she wasn't getting enough attention. Because everybody literally was catering to the Caucasians, just two Caucasians, but literally everyone was going above and beyond the call of duty to make sure the Caucasians felt comfortable. So she broke her glass, her wine glass. It was a nice glass, and she broke it. So, oh my stars, it was a guest that was there, a Negro guest, and he flew across the table. Woo! Don't fret, it's okay. Don't worry about this glass. And so she put her damsel in distress face on because she knows, you know, what to do to get the attention. So she's, and everybody's just, oh, no, don't worry about the glass. So the Negro male that ran to save the glass, that ran to assure her that everything was fine, went and got the glass. I'm going to fix it. And I said, so you're going to put that broke glass in your pocket and take it home? And he said, yeah, I'm going to fix it. I said, you're going to put a broke glass in your pocket, your suit pocket, and take it home and fix the glass and bring it back to this house? Yeah, I'm going to fix it. It's okay. And I just, like, oh. So, prayer time. It's prayer time. We're going to bless the food that's late. And the son of the elderly man that I take care of, the one that I stated that was talking trash to me a few weeks ago, he decided to bless the table. So he's talking or saying whatever he's saying, and the Caucasian lady interjected and said some foolishness. And so he said, yeah, that's true too. So I was just like, oh my stars. So now we're at the table. They're eating because everything was cold and everything was infested with pork. So I just didn't understand the turkey's wrap, the pork, bacon. Everything is just literally, the dressing had pork in it. I didn't understand. So everything's cold. It's just insane, but everyone's still eating. So the Caucasian young girl isn't getting any attention now. So she's going to make these pouty faces because she knows at some point someone's going to look at her to check and see if she's okay. So someone looked over at her to check and see if she was okay. So she's pouting. It's like, what's wrong? We'll just call her Lillianne. What's wrong, Lillianne? And so she's just, whoo. And so another black male, what's wrong, Lillianne? So she's, whoo. So the older, the ex-wife said, you know what's wrong? Talking to her ex-husband. You know what's wrong with her? You know what's wrong? And then she reiterated that the issue that the Caucasian young adult was having was the fact that the son, the Negro son, was going to buy a motorcycle. So now all of the attention is on her because she's crying at the table because he's going to buy a motorcycle. And now everything is shifted to where how reckless this black male is, how he does not need to have a bike, how incompetent he is, even though he just went and got his M1 license. He's just so they're just slandering this man at this dinner table. So I'm listening to it, and no one's interjecting. Everyone's just riding on this young male about his bike and what he's going to do. And they're just the girls crying at the table, just this big pile. And I'm just looking. I said, are you guys really going to do this to him right now? And he just said, well, every time I make a decision, everyone acts like it's not a good decision. Everyone always undermines everything that I say. And he's only talking about the Caucasians in his life because he has that Caucasian mother and now that new girlfriend. So it was just terrible to see how everybody collectively rolled on this young man. So I could just imagine how it could have been in his home being raised with this
lady as a mother, and be it that he selected a Caucasian mate, and she merges with his mother against him, it had to be terrible. So I'm walking in the kitchen, and the two Caucasians were in the kitchen talking about how reckless this man is. They're still talking about this incident, which is not even necessary at this moment. So I'm just passing through, and it's like, Mary, what do you think? What do you think about it? I asked her. She knows. What do you think? I said, I don't think anything. Well, what do you think? What do you think? I was like, I'll tell you this. You'll be number two if you're standing up in here pouting. You'll be number two. And I just walked off, you know, because I didn't understand. But next week I'll call in and let you know about how the incident went, because I talked to the male that kind of insulted me, the black male, in front of the Caucasians a week ago. So I'll do that for next week, so I can let other people share their story too. But that's what I wanted to share.
Appreciate that, Bay Area caller. I'm of the opinion that her offer of alcohol, or whomever offered the alcohol, just what I know about racist man, racist woman, that could have been a total setup, particularly she shared before in working in the healthcare industry. It could have been a total, oh, do you want something to drink? Do you want something to drink? And then as soon as you get the selfie real quick, boop, and then go get on the line and call whoever your supervisor is and be like, oh, she was drinking on the job. She was over here. She's supposed to be taking care of us. And look at this. She was all tipsy. I don't even know if she can do her job correctly. Like, I just, that is the way I think it is. It's logical. It's wise for us to think in that manner. Excellent kind. And even just her response, because I think you said that when you said, hey, I can't drink, I'm on the job, the white woman said, oh, smart woman. That right there further makes me think that could have been a total setup to try to cost you your job. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's my thinking, just based on what you shared in that portion of the story. If other folks have commentary, questions about that, or anybody else that dialed in workplace racism. I know we had one caller who had comments on workplace racism. Feel free to share. Lines should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so we have I consider myself at my job, you know, I wouldn't even say lower management, but maybe I can be considered lower management. And we have, you know, middle and upper management. So the middle and the lower and middle management pretty much have a weekly meeting. I really don't see any reason for me being there, because I have someone that's directly over me that is supposed to be there, a non-white, non-black person that's supposed to be there. And but this non-white, non-black person, you know, conveniently finds a way not to be at that meeting with the middle management or whatever. So I have to attend in his place. So I'm in there, you know, only black person, of course, and in a sea of, I don't want to say a sea, that's a metaphor, about 10 to 12 white people, you know. So I'm just sitting there, and I feel like I'm being, again, I feel like I'm being held hostage, because it's really nothing that, they're not going to take any of my suggestions or like, so I just get to hear white people talk, you know, just talk, not freely, of course, cause I'm in the room, but anyway, so, some type of, there's a task that's something that's, missing. There's a deficiency somewhere in the building that we work in. So I said, okay, that's something I can take care of that. So I told the main boss, I said, yeah, I can take care of that. And then someone directly under him says, yeah, you take care of that and take care of that today. So right then, you know, my blood pressure rises, but you know, I don't think I show it physically, but just inside I'm burning. So inside I'm like, okay. And then, you know, they start discussing another topic, and then someone's, mind it, I'm not there to be a secretary. I'm not there to take notes. I mean, I'm not there to take notes with someone else. I'm just there just to get information and pass it on to the people that are that I manage or whatever. But anyway, something's mentioned
and then someone's name is mentioned, and then the primary boss looks at me and said, "Yeah, write that down." And you know, and I just kind of look at him like, I don't need to, you know, I didn't say that, but in a sense, I'm like, I don't need to write that down. Like, what do you, like, why are you guys barking these, you know, orders at me? So I just felt like I just felt like everyone's treating me like a, you know, a dog or something, really much, pretty much, or they just treated me like with no respect whatsoever. I was just the nigger in the room, and they just treated me like that. So they, you know, barked little orders at me, or they felt maybe that my intelligence or I probably, you know, they had to reinforce everything that was said because maybe I'm so dumb that I wouldn't get it. But I just felt definitely out of place, and I felt like my blood pressure rose, and I felt just, yeah, I felt like racism was being practiced on me. And then, you know, I noticed that one caller, a caller that used to say, I believe, I don't know who it was, a female caller used to always talk about white people and their relationship with dogs. And it's like, yeah, I understand their relationship with dogs too. And it kind of relates to non-white people even more. It's just they love dogs because they can just have dominion over something. You know, they can just have complete dominion over it, and they can use them in whatever way they need to. Anyway, that's it.
I agree. It sounds like they were practicing white supremacy against you, and that might be an illustration of John Henryism. We talked about that concept when Tariq Nasheed was on the program a week or two back, where you get abused, white people are terrorizing you, talking, you know, really rude to you, and yeah, make sure you do it, and do it today, and that sort of thing, just talking down to you, and you, you know, try not to get upset, you want to keep your job, that sort of thing, but you said you felt like you were burning up on the inside. I think that's getting right to the core of the term, those sorts of instances, I don't call them microaggressions, that's the popular jargon that they use on it, those are acts of racism, white supremacy, and it's just terroristic speech. We just talk to you like we're back on the plantation, good old days. Yeah, boy, go over there and do that. Make sure you do it today, nigger, right now. Write that down. Just, I think for white people, they love that sort of thing. That adds joy to their day. I can go in and talk nasty to all our little nigger women and nigger boys that we got here that are going to be working today. It's just great. Just awesome. Makes me feel better. Did you hear what I said to them in the meeting today? They love that sort of thing. It just adds joy to their day. I'm not surprised. That's the sort of thing in terms of just being codified. I think I recommend that all the time, and just being cognizant that that's happening so that you can codify how you want to respond if you feel the need to respond at all. But I really think it's very important in just understanding that's what it means to be white. That's what you can look forward to from whites, and I would say in all spheres. Doesn't matter what field you happen to be in, what your salary rank is. I've heard President Obama, even I think Pam, when she comes on the program, she has shared consistently about black officials that are elected, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and saying that they had shared privately, as you know, could be inaccurate, but I trust her source, where she said that they had shared privately how many times they had similar moments where white people were talking to them and just being really crude and racist, talking to them like they were back on the good old plantation days. That is, you know, racism, white supremacy. That's why we devote the time to workplace racism. But I think the super important part, just being prepared for that so that you don't fly off the handle and being unprepared, not expecting it, being shocked, having your response, how you want to deal with it. And even as I've encouraged consistently, making notes that you can document this sort of behavior, particularly if they're not talking to other people in that way, because we definitely want to be about equal treatment on the job, even if you don't bring it up at all. But I also think it's important to document when that sort of thing happens. You can, you know, use that or not, that suggestion. Other folks have comments on what we've heard thus far? Have your own incidents of workplace racism you want to share?
Yeah, I have a comment on what he just said, and I noticed, because at my last job, I dealt with that quite extensively, and while they're doing that, they make eye contact with each other, sort of like, you know, like how you were just saying, you know, yeah, look how I talk to them. They're doing that with their eyes to each other while they're doing it. You know, they'll glance over to the other one, and he'll get that look like he wants to laugh, or the kid, you know, and they're going to keep it straight
And yeah, they were very good with that. And they do that on purpose.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, to the guy that spoke before, Thomas in New York, I'm sorry that happened to you, but have you been able to research your company's, maybe the, I don't know if the employee handbook might have it, but if there's a separate policy on workplace violence or office decorum and how, you know, colleagues should treat one another, including, you know, how you speak to one another, because that may fall under that policy, and you may, depending on the circumstance and how much you want to pursue it, you may be able to ping that person. So just as Gus suggests, you can continue to document, but if you feel it falls under that particular, I don't know the word, but anyway, you can move forward with possibly a grievance or a complaint.
I don't think that was Thomas in New York who was having that problem. Thomas in New York did just speak, but I think that was a different male caller who was sharing that incident. But that is always, I think, a great suggestion to refer to your employee handbook policies and procedures to see if they have anything that describes exactly what she just laid out. I always think that's a great idea because you can use their very policies to get some protection sometimes.
Yeah, to piggyback off of that. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying definitely. Thank you.
Okay. To piggyback off of what you were saying, I was thinking the same thing. You definitely want to go to the handbook and look into that. And I would have actually asked him to repeat what he said and started recording what he said right then and there. I don't know if you had, because you said that you had to go in your boss's place before, so I don't know if that's a regular occurrence for you. But if you're going to enough of these meetings and that has never happened to anyone else, I would have brought it up right then and there on the spot. I've come to enough of these meetings and I have not seen anyone tell anyone else, you better write that down. And I'm the only black person in this meeting, and you're talking to me in a derogatory, condescending fashion. So I want to make sure I record this because, and especially if it's in the handbook, I don't believe that this is the way you're supposed to be treating me or anyone else in the company as far as the company policy is concerned. And usually once you approach it that way, they'll start thinking a little bit differently simply because your approach to it is where you're coming from an experience scenario. I've been to these meetings before. No one has talked to in that manner. I'm the only black person in the room, and historically we have been talked to this way throughout our history in this country, and I want to address this immediately. So I need to record what you're saying. And I don't know if you did record it. Definitely record it. Definitely check in your company handbook for the information that the previous speaker was just talking about. And then from there, if there is information regarding the treatment of employees and coworkers, definitely, I would say, try and move forward from that angle and write it as best to the best of your ability, as detailed as possible, with the date, the time that it happened, who said what, if anybody else responded, what that person said, just as much detail as possible before you make the steps to move forward. And first thing, look at your employee handbook.
I would absolutely love to do those things. I'm pretty sure I'm not going to. And that's not to say that the suggestions aren't valid. Definitely think they're valid. But, you know, I'm in a room full of, you know, again, people that are a lot more powerful than me, all white people. The tone in which they said this thing, they could easily, you know, they could just say, oh, you know, I just told them to, you know, something, or I don't know, I just feel like the odds are stacked against me. And then, of course, you know, I'm, you know, just how white people got it set it up. They have it set up to where, you know, if I do that, I'm going to subject myself to a lot more racism in the interim, you know, in between time if I were to. But, you know, I'm in the military, and not that the military has rules and regulations just like every other organization, but it's a little, you know, slightly different. But, and again, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't getting mad at the person that, you know, I'm sitting in for, because, you know, I do have a feeling that he's kind of setting me up a little bit because he doesn't want, maybe he, but, you know, I definitely, he's definitely no one I could confide in or share it with, but yeah. But thanks everyone for your suggestions. I will start documenting this stuff, and maybe I could, you know, do something constructive, like blow some steam off by, you know, writing about it or something like that, because I don't see me pursuing it otherwise. A white person would probably have to get up and slap me in the face for me to be able to, you know, get something done or get some type of something done to them. But anyway, thanks.
Just real quick. On, I think it was Roz's suggestion about, he said he would have stopped him, asked him to repeat it and write it down. You don't have to, I say this all the time, and I think some other people have used this and they got constructive results. You don't have to pursue anything, right? You don't have to get a lawyer. You don't have to go talk to your supervisor, anything like that. I mean, as calm as if you were asking for a napkin or, you know, telling somebody no thank you when he says, yeah, write it down right now. Make sure you do it today. Just, oh, could you repeat that, please? And just write it down. Write it down. Do it today. Boop. Okay. And then proceed with the meeting with a smile, not being angry. You don't have to hand it. I have seen just when white people start seeing that you, number one, are not going to fly off the handle, that you're in control emotionally. And then number two, that you're paying attention to words and even writing down what they say. Oh, man. I have seen where that has worked very constructively, where white people stopped being reckless and just saying anything around them, and they started being much more cautious and how they talk to you. And I've seen where people have said that that worked out and got very good results from them, where it didn't cause any more problems. There was no retaliation, anything like that. White people just started being much more careful about what they said and how they talked to that particular black person. So that's one I can toss out as well. If you feel like you're in a situation where you don't want to set yourself up for additional mistreatment from these racists.
Yeah, I was going to say that situation, you know the situation better than anyone else because that's your daily reality. So there's no judgment on how you deal with it. That, you know, we're all trapped in the system of white supremacy, and whatever we can do to try and get by as smoothly as possible is what is necessary. So whatever you choose to do, I just wish you the best, because that's really an uncomfortable scenario to be in. So certainly you don't have to justify any choices that you make.
Thomas, were you going to get something in as well? Did I interrupt you? Or?
Yeah, I was just going to add, man. I think his best defense in this matter is just to go into work every day or every time you have this meeting and expect nothing but the most tackiest behavior. And like you did, stay cool, calm, and collected, because you already know what's going to happen. You already expect it. And that's that, you know, because they're gonna play it like, man, he's hyper-sensitive. You know how these people are so sensitive. You know how they do it. You know, especially in you pedophile with the military. So I would just go in there with the mindset like this is how all white people are, and I expect nothing but tacky behavior from them at all times.
And on top of that, you know, I'm sure everyone on the line is being bombarded with these holiday parties where they want you to eat this crappy, unhealthy food and, you know, drink and, you know, sit around laughing joke with, you know, people that mean you no good whatsoever. So, but thanks everyone for your suggestions. I appreciate it.
Okay, I have an incident of workplace racism, and to piggyback off what the previous caller just said, I had a Christmas party that I had to go to with my wife for the company. This was last night. And all I could say, I haven't been to a party in a very long time, but I came up producing and performing hip-hop music in the 90s and whatnot. And so I haven't been to a party in a long time. I stay away from that sort of environment simply because I party myself out every year. And this was the first party I've been to in a very long time. So all I could say is I didn't really discuss this with my wife until later, but
ultimately, all I could think of was, this is what domination looks like. People were drinking. The bartenders were making the drinks very heavily strong. So if you asked for anything, they were putting three-quarters of it was liquor, and maybe a quarter of it would be, let's say, orange juice or rum and coke or whatever it is. So when, by the time I got there late on purpose. I didn't want to get there too early. I didn't want to spend too much time. I either was going to come early and leave early, which I didn't get the opportunity to do. So I just went late and then left it just before everything ended. So people were already drinking and things like this, and I was just observing the behavior of white people. And what I noticed was there were numerous tragic arrangements, and I was shocked because I hadn't seen these people in an arena in which they were in a party atmosphere. And the sheer number of tragic arrangements, all of them that I took note of, were all white men with non-white females. The other thing that I noticed is white men have a subconscious ownership complex over the bodies of black people. Every non-white female, and they were all white non-white females with white males, these men would grab their backsides and squeeze them. And it's like as they got drunker, they would do it more often and more vigorously. And it was so disconcerting to me because it's just so disrespectful. It's not something I would ever imagine doing to anyone. I don't believe in public displays of affection, especially because there's children, and it's just not appropriate to me. It's just not something you do. And it was just amazing to see the relaxed atmosphere in which these men felt it was okay to just either grab them on the sides of their backsides, pinch their behinds, or even dig up in their cracks. It was just horrible. And then the homosexuality is just out of control. Just the sheer number of different types of homosexuals, how I guess, flamboyant they became as they got more intoxicated. I felt like gay white males are at their freest because they're gay. And I just believe that there's such an undercurrent of homosexuality that even non-homosexual white males have an undercurrent vibration of homosexuality, too. And it seems to me like the so-called straight ones seem to be much more, I would say, sexually off-balance in the way that they come out publicly versus the gay ones seem to be more flamboyant and open. And I noticed that the black females that were, some of the black females that were in these tragic arrangements, I just felt so sorry for them because I just could imagine what these men would do or say in secret, the iniquity they were working secret behind closed doors, and what kind of mental whammy they're putting on these females. And it's just, it was just a mind-blowing case study in just white psychopathology. And it really made me think of Yorubu. It made me think of Maroon by me discussing in the story that Yorubu was an incomplete being. And I really believe that the antisexual nature of white people comes from them being incomplete. There seems to me like an imbalance. There's a part of them missing. And for the males, it's feminine. So they not only, I believe, made Christianity the most homosexual religion on earth by removing the female, but that is how it plays out culturally. And then for white females, that's lesbianism. There's an aspect of the black masculine self, that twin, that's missing. And also, if you look at them culturally, the fact that the men would collude, as far as post-traumatic cave syndrome, would collude with one another sexually, as well as going out on hunting expeditions, leaving the females alone for long periods of time, this kind of further cemented this mentality of lesbianism and so-called homosexuality amongst them. And it's almost like, I just saw it like them infecting non-white people with this anti-sexual disease, and then it's spread, and now they're using science to normalize it, when in the 70s it was considered a mental illness. I truly believe it's an acute, just like the early Freud described in the United Compensatory Code concept, it's an acute form of mental insanity. And that's exactly what I saw on the full display, and it was just culture as a weapon. I just saw that just the visions of how white people have used their culture as the most devastating
nuclear warhead that humanity has ever experienced. I've always said, I wrote it in an essay, the most valuable export that ever came out of Europe was racism, white supremacy. They had nothing else to offer the world. They came from a cold environment with no resources whatsoever. They had to wear animal skins and hunt every day for their sustenance, whereas in Africa and other tropical spaces, we had access to these things, which helped us to develop at a much more rapid pace. And when they left after the Ice Age, they left with white supremacy, and they infected the planet with it. And last night, I was able to see the display of anti-sexual culture being normalized, and how our people have been so conditioned, and non-white people have been so conditioned to accept that as a normal behavior, as something that is inherent in humanity, as a normal aspect of behavior. And I was thinking about, I was talking to Thomas in New York earlier this evening, and I told him, human beings are the only living creature in which we have gender confusion. When a female lion sees a male lion with a dark mane, they know what he is. They don't expect him to go and have sex with another male lion. They know
you're
what he's there for.
Away from workplace racism, just a tad.
No problem. But it's just essentially just the culture of white supremacy and anti-sexual behavior is a marriage made in hell, and I just bore witness to it in the worst way last night. Thank you.
Right. I'm sorry. At least you were codified. Did you spoke with you? Because that is something that I've recommended before. If you're going to go, to try not go alone. Were you able to kind of get a game plan together with your partner? I think you said you went with your wife, unless I'm mistaken. Were you all like codified in terms of how you were going to function and what you were going to try to do to look out for one another while you were there together?
Absolutely. Right. That is absolutely it. We did not drink. We don't drink. So that was not even an issue. I just went and touch base with specific people that I wanted to make sure that they saw me. As a result, because I'm pretty well known on my job, I got a lot more attention than I intended. But we got back together. We spent the night basically with one another, and then we left early, like right before everything ended. We said, well, let's leave so we don't deal with the crowd and all the further aggravation. So we did have a plan. We executed it well, and we got up out of there. But it was just, my eyes were just transformed. Just to go to a party in situation, understanding the way the system of white supremacy works versus how I used to look at parties when I was in hip-hop culture, it was just night and day. And like I said, it's something I would never want to experience again. So I'm glad I don't go to parties. I will never go to parties. And if I can avoid it next time, I will avoid it, like the plague.
Sounds like it. Yes, sir. Go ahead, Thomas.
Yeah, I think a lot of that groping that white men do to non-white women, they do that when there's males around of the same races that non-white women they're with, because they feel very inadequate. They know that they don't belong with that woman, and chances are she's looking at that black male like, you know, and they constantly have to be reinforced by that black woman that, no, I'm with you. And I think that's one of the things they do to show their possession, to show their ownership, you know, to the other people of that same, that woman's same race, to show them that, hey, you know, this is mine. I think they do that on purpose.
Right on. We have about 5 minutes before we wrap things up. Did we miss anybody? Anybody who hasn't shared for workplace racism had something that they definitely wanted to get in, a comment about something they heard or their own situation they want to make sure they share before we close out?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir. Just speak up a little bit.
Okay. Greetings, guests, and to the rest of the callers. I'm usually late to my first class, which is science, and when I am late, people would just time how late I am and just tell me the time. For example, oh, you're 15 minutes and 37 seconds late, and I'll just be like, oh, and I'll just sit down and do my work. Or if I was early, people would just be so surprised and just start applauding out of nowhere, and I would just wouldn't say anything and just sit down and do my work, just so confused. So I remember this one day when I was late again. As I opened the door, I heard this yelling, and all of a sudden, and I just thought, oh, they must be playing a game. But I was wrong. The teacher was in the middle of a lesson, and somebody just said, I won. So when I sat down, one of my friends told me that everybody placed a bet on how late I would be. Some said I would be early, some said I would be late, some said I would be 10 or 20 minutes late. They betted a whole bunch of things, like candy or change or a lot of stuff. I was just so confused and angry because you basically interrupted the whole lesson just to acknowledge how late I am, which didn't make any sense to me. But that's all I wanted to share. Thank you.
Wow. That is, for folks who are listening in, I believe this is our listener in the Bay Area, high school student. He's called in before to give us some of his different experiences. A young black male in an environment with, unfortunately, a lot of young racist white females, racist white teens. Even remembering the report that was at Berkeley High School from just a few weeks ago, one of these little racist urchins left some sort of threat about lynching black students on the school computer. But that is fascinating because you're talking, I assume that these are probably little racists that are younger than 17. And the amount of attention, that's the first thing that sticks out, the amount of focus and attention that they are directing on you. And when you're in class, what time? I mean, specific, like looking at our watch, like what time is he going to get here, and sharing and cataloging day after day, studying victims of racism. When did you start noticing, like, oh, wow, this is, you know, they're really focusing a lot on when I arrive, what time, cataloging, tracing patterns in terms of my arrival to class? When did you start noticing this was going down pretty heavy?
Well, I started noticing this about a few weeks ago, because they would just start doing it after they noticed it's been weeks I've been late, and they would just start doing that. So yeah, it's been a few weeks when I noticed.
Are you the only black student in this class?
Oh no, there are more black students.
Okay.
In that class.
Okay. Just at least for me, I mean, that's a long running facet of white supremacy for whites to constantly insist that black people are not on time and are late for everything, and CP time and everything. It's, I mean, it's a whole thing, probably tons of dissertations and books on that. But at least for me, the attention, that's number one, and just being focused. And then the precision, we're cataloging day after day and making wagers on this and disrupting class because we're paying so much attention to this one black student and when he's going to get here, and even wagering amongst ourselves to see who can be most accurate, engaging, predicting the behavior of a black person. That is, just in my opinion, that is fascinating that you're seeing that sort of behavior, that sort of mindset from young whites. The young racists already have got it where they are attuned to and working to accurately predict the behavior of black people. That, I think, that trend, you will see that consistently on the part of whites when they are really studying black people. What can we get more information about you? Get all of your patterns and habits down so that we can better control and manipulate you forever. That is wild. Did anybody else have any thoughts on that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I believe appropriate for his
Ma'am, your volume is really low. Can you start over and just speak up, because your volume
Hello?
That much better, much better.
Okay, sorry. I think it's inappropriate for his teacher to be condoning that kind of behavior, and she could be written up. I don't know if the young man would want to pursue that, but that's just something to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. I think Ross and Thomas were going to add on that.
Yes, I was just going to say, they study us with scientific precision, and that is a prime example of it. Talk about form like Voltron around one idea and just use that to extend their ability to dominate and terrorize you in a situation where you're supposed to be learning. I agree with Gus. It is fascinating, and you can see that that was something they applied in old history, and it's just resurrected again. I believe a lot of what Dr. Wilson, Gus, Neely Fuller, Thomas, and a lot of others have said, they're going back to that plantation-style behavior where they're monitoring every minute of your day, and it needs to be productive under a system of white supremacy and contribute to that system, or you're going to have problems. Wow, this is really something.
Was that Thomas? Were you going to add something on?
Yes. Well, one thing I would like to tell the guy is you're going to deal with that for the rest of your life, with time.
to always try to be on time when you deal with white people. That will cost you a lot if you're not on time in the real world. Number two is, you know, time is a concept. The way it is today, that's not the concept of time our people once had. You know, this to the second time, way that they handle time to the second is because they don't have time. They don't have a lot of time to be here. You know, unfortunately, we'll always be here. That's the way they look at it because it's only natural. So time is always going to be one of those things that they're going to use against us, and it's best to always be on time because they're going to do this to you in the workplace for sure, and that'll cost you your job. You know, I mean, you can be late to school, but not to work, you know, so be very, very efficient with your time going forward. Remember that that's their thing.
Okay. I would like to add, too, that I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. It's okay.
I was just saying that, you know, I'm sure he's not the only person that's been late to class, but yet, you know, these people choose, of course, a black person to really make it fun and just an activity to really, you know, really put it out there that this, you know, this black person is late, and just to continue to perpetuate that, you know, that the racist behavior that they talk about black people being late. It's just, yeah, it's amazing. Or it's racist.
Definitely appreciate the our counter-racist, young counter-racist learning and trying to get a better understanding of this at an early age, which I wish I had done as well. That is fascinating. If you write anything up on that or have additional follow-ups, please share. If anything, that just, for me, further confirms that it is a dangerous lie when people say that the young white people are different, they've changed, that it's only crotchety old white people like Donald Trump and Paula Deen. Once they die out, this problem will be taken care of. Everything will be cool. The young whites, they love President Obama and Beyonce and Rihanna. Hey, they are not racist. It is a lie, and this is just another illustration to make that point. We had some in the audio clips as well. But anything else that you want to add? Are we talking crazy? Does it sound like what we're saying doesn't make sense to you?
Oh, no, it makes a lot of sense.
Okay. Right on. Definitely appreciate that contribution. Great observation. And just keep us informed. You will continue to see things and pick out things that you're seeing with your little classmates, or even things that are happening with some of the other black students that you're in school with. Definitely share. It is super important, and just further shows the patterns that you see consistently amongst white people worldwide throughout history. They pretty much stick to the same codification. They make adjustments, they make refinements and updates, but it's the core of it is basic same principles, and a lot of it revolves around studying black people in detail. That is another huge lie, saying that white people don't understand black people, that they don't know enough about black people. That is hogwash. They invest a lot of time in studying and scrutinizing their victims so that they can continue and, in fact, get better at abusing us. That's from their perspective, get better at abusing us. We will call it a broadcast since we did our 3 hours. I believe it was Ross who mentioned he was talking about some of the documentaries, the Lumumba documentary and Peter Tosh, some of the others. And then he said today on C-SPAN that one of our previous guests, Charles Cobb, and I think he said it was a whole panel, they were talking about the legacy of Stokely Carmichael. That is on C-SPAN. I thought it would be. C-SPAN, they tend to be very efficient with their programs. If you see something that day, it's probably going to be online the same day. I posted the link on my Facebook page if folks want to check it out. I think, or I don't think, I'm looking at it. It says American History TV, The Life and Legacy of Stokely Carmichael. That's the title. If you go to C-SPAN, you can just search for, you could probably search for Stokely Carmichael. I searched for Charles Cobb and it popped up that way, but you could probably do it either or and it'll pop up. Again, I put the link on my Facebook page so you can check it out right there, but it is available. You can watch it at your leisure. Thanks everyone for tuning into the broadcast. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Sunday evening. We will be back not tomorrow, but Monday, same program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Black female, actually, this is a return guest, Gwen Ragsdale. She is a black author, though, but she's been on the program before. 2010, I think, was the last time she was with us. She wrote a book more recently that's dealing with the relationship between black females and white women. I am concerned. I'll have to leave it there. I haven't finished the book, so I'm trying to reserve judgment until I complete the book. But I am concerned because the book begins where it's focused on, part of it is set during plantation slavery, the way it operated then, older form of slavery, white supremacy, where this black female, she's been enslaved and she's on a plantation with a quote unquote mean enslaver, but she hopes to go to a plantation with a good quote unquote enslaver. Who is a quote-unquote abolitionist, and she's trying to free people. It just, I feel like we already get enough images and representations and rhetoric about good white people and John Brown and Tim Wise, any white person that's supposed to be not racist and did all they could to help the niggers. I feel like there's a lot of that already, so that was kind of, man, it gave me pause. To begin the book with, you know, this narrative. It is fiction, but to begin the book with this narrative about this good white, and I think her name is Miss Blue Eyes. Like, it really gave me pause, but I'm trying to be patient and reserve and see where it's going to go. But she should be here on Monday, and I am going to, you know, bring that up and get her thoughts about that, because I think that is pretty rampant. And in my view, it is not accurate. It's just not giving a proper representation of what it means to be white, to have all of this time and energy focused on good white people and John Brown and wasn't he cool, and, you know, the newer manifestations of this quote unquote good white person. But that should be Monday. Looking forward to it. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Gwen Ragsdale. She has her own museum talking about the importance of accurate information about white supremacy. Her own museum set up in Pennsylvania focused on racism, white supremacy, and the history of what black people have done and ways that we have responded and tried to work against racism, white supremacy, things whites have done to us, and then try to act like it didn't happen. But looking forward to having her back on the program. You can even go in the archives and hear when she was on the program. I think 2000, twice, her and her husband, a black male, was on 2010. At any rate, if you have any questions, confusion, things didn't make sense, feel free, drop a line, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Invest if you think the broadcast is constructive, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. Again, drop an email if you need a physical mailing address. Thank you kindly for everyone tuning in. I will again emphasize sobriety would be best under conditions of war. A+. We heard from folks, if you got to go to any of these quote-unquote holiday parties or office get-togethers for work or anything else, if you got to go and they're serving alcohol, I would encourage don't drink. You don't want to get into any of that around, particularly if the white people there are intoxicated. That's even more of an incentive for you to be sober, lucid, clear thinking, so you can be on your P's and Q's, monitoring what's happening around you, because it can go from tacky to lethal in those sort of situations. So that would be my recommendation. Under any circumstances, it would be best for us to be sober, particularly if you're going to be driving, if you're going to be behind the wheel, if you're going to be the passenger or the pedestrian. Man, you do not want to be under the influence that is giving racists. You could be making their job easier. You never know when you're going to bump into a Daniel Holtzclaw on the road. Do everything that you possibly can to minimize the likelihood of coming in contact with them, and to make sure that you're clear thinking so you can make the best possible decisions to protect yourself, anybody else that you might be responsible for. That being said, thanks again for tuning in, and we'll be back in about 48 hours. Creator, it has been time. Help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. Help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed. I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.